Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
And to mark Black History Month in the UK, this week we're looking back at some of the landmark events from British black history. Today we're going back to September 1943, when the celebrated West Indian cricketer Leary Constantine took the Imperial Hotel in London to court for refusing to let him and his family stay there because of their race. In 2018, Susan Hume looked into the story, using some of the BBC's archive interviews with Leary Constantine.
I had a receipt in my pocket, and when we arrived, they accepted the English section of our party and rejected the coloured section. And although we had booked the rooms for all, told me they were full up and so on, and I produced my receipt and they made excuses. But eventually we had to leave the hotel. And in order to set the example that the law wouldn't discriminate, I took action against the hotel.
I said, "So shine, sunshine, upon Leary Constantine."
By the end of his life, Leary Constantine was a familiar figure in British public life. As well as an outstanding cricketer, he was knighted. Sir Leary Constantine was eventually made a lord. He was a governor of the BBC, rector of the prestigious St Andrews University, and a politician and diplomat in his native Trinidad, where he was born in 1901. But here he is in the 1940s talking about a background that was a far cry from the British establishment.
My grandparents were slaves. It's queer now to think back to my childhood, to see my grandfather sitting in the hot sunshine on the top step of his little bungalow, leaning his back against the door, and to realize that when he was a youth, he was a slave. And my grandmother, too.
Leary Constantine's own father, though, had been an international cricketer, playing for the West Indies side in England in the early 1900s. At home, all the family, including Leary's mother, played, sometimes with whatever they had to hand.
He was famous to the nation as a cricketing sensation.
I remember my first cricket bat when I was 4 or 5. It wasn't a cricket bat in the sense that English boys know them. It was made from a branch cut from a coconut tree. The ball we played with was a young orange or grapefruit, dried in the sun till the rind came off, and rolled round until it became flexible, and we could get 40 or 50 runs off it before we demanded a new ball. All the boys in our family played cricket. My father first came to England with the West Indies team in 1900, and while he was over, he made friends with two Irishmen called Leary and Vivian. They gave him such a good time in Ireland that he said he would call his son after one of them.
His run up to the wicket was the most frightening thing in big cricket. That's why.
And it was cricket that brought Leary Constantine to the UK too, first as an all-rounder on tour with the West Indies, and then as a professional in the small northern English cotton mill town of Nelson in Lancashire. Life there for Leary, his wife and daughter, was hard to begin with, as the only people of African descent in the town. Children would peer in the windows or ring the doorbell for a glimpse, and adults didn't behave much better.
The white man had not been used to a black man in his midst, competing on terms of equality with him on the cricket fields, making runs and being cheered. I got anonymous letters from time to time saying that you can't play cricket for toffee, why don't you go back to your country? Time after time these letters came and my heart was almost broken. But my wife, I want to pay her this tribute, said, "Let us turn round and fight, Leary." So I played for Nelson for 9 years, won the championship on 7 occasions, and were runners-up on the other 2. I became pretty popular, though I say it myself.
But when the Second World War broke out, other people from what were then British colonies came to the UK to work in the factories. Leary Constantine took a job in the Ministry of Labour, helping these new workers to settle in. Race relations, he felt, were improving. But then the arrival of servicemen from racially segregated America set things back.
Then the white Americans came and created trouble. Not only for the coloured Americans, but for all coloured people in the area.
He, his wife and his daughter Gloria had been travelling with a group of white friends, including his chief at the Ministry of Labour, Arnold Watson. They'd booked ahead a London hotel, the Imperial in Russell Square, where several hundred US servicemen were staying.
When we arrived, they said, "We're very sorry, we don't take foreigners." And of course Gloria was at the counter, and she came back to me and said, "We are in the wrong place, Daddy. They don't take coloured people."
Not for money, but on principle, he decided to go to court. During the case, the Times reported Arnold Watson's account of what had been said and the offensive word used to describe Leary Constantine and his family.
Mr. Watson, Mr. Constantine's chief at the ministry, arrived and was told, "We're not going to have these in our hotel. He can stop the night, but if he doesn't go tomorrow morning, his luggage will be put outside and his door locked." Mr. Watson said he found Mr. and Mrs. Constantine looking most disconsolate and unhappy. He told the manageress, "You cannot turn Mr. Constantine and his party out of the hotel like this," to which she repeated she would not have in the hotel. He asked her why, and she said, "Because of the Americans." He pointed out that Mr. Constantine was a civil servant and a British subject. She said, "He is a
nigger."
Cross-examined about whether the manageress had really used that word, Mr. Watson replied, "She did, many times. I noticed the offensive way she used the word."
Other Afro-Caribbean people didn't believe he could possibly win his case, a black man against a white-owned business. But he had his backers. Questions were asked in Parliament. We've recreated the scene from the official report at the time.
"Can I ask the Secretary of State for the Colonies whether his attention has been drawn to the exclusion from the Imperial Hotel London of Mr. Constantine, a Negro citizen, and what steps he's taking to prevent the exercise by hotel keepers and others of racial discrimination, which is repugnant to the tradition of this country?"
"My right honourable friend, the Home Secretary, is aware of the incident referred to in these questions. It is understood that legal proceedings are pending, and it would therefore be improper for me to comment on the incident itself. The hotel in question is the Imperial Hotel, Russell Square. I'm glad, however, to have the opportunity of stating on behalf of my right honourable and gallant friend that he most strongly condemns any form of racial discrimination against colonial people in this country."
"On whose instance are proceedings being taken?"
"They are being taken by Mr. Constantine."
"I hope he bowls about."
I argued that the law of England had no room for discrimination, and that if I proved my contract and a breach of it by the company, judgment is almost automatic. So when I got judgment, and the hotel people had to pay my costs, hundreds of letters came to me congratulating me on the step I had taken. Hotel proprietors became a little more amenable to coloured people coming in.
After the war, Leary Constantine continued to fight racism with determination, but, he said himself, without bitterness, and became a popular national figure both in the UK and his native Trinidad.
"What eye in me eye, for it's time now to say goodbye. He was famous to the nation as a cricket in sensation. That's why we feeling so sad. Leary is going back to Trinidad. So shine, sunshine, upon a Leary Constantine."
Leary Constantine.
"You're dirt. We think you're dirt, Paul.
Who is we?
The West, all the superpowers, everything you believe in, Paul. They think you're dirt. They think you're dumb. You're worthless."
"I'm afraid I don't understand what you are saying, sir."
"Oh, come on, don't bullshit me, Paul. You're the smartest man here. You got them all eating out of your hands. You could own this freaking hotel, except for one thing. You're black. You're not even a nigger. You're an African.
More than 1,000 African migrants, many of whom have risked their lives to try to get to the United States, have been stuck in limbo in southern Mexico. They want to be able to travel north to the U.S. safely. They are threatening to go en masse if they don't get Mexican travel documents. But Mexico is under pressure from the Trump administration to stem the tide of migrants. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
For nearly 2 months, hundreds of African migrants have been camped out in the southern Mexican city of Tapachula. They've pitched dozens of tents in front of the main Mexican immigration detention facility here. Kids kick around a tattered flat soccer ball on a concrete plaza in front of the facility, while women listening to music squat under a canvas tent and cook rice and soup on small charcoal cookers. Once the afternoon rains come, the camp daily turns into a muddy mess. Despite the terrible conditions, the migrants from countries including Cameroon, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Angola say they won't leave until they're guaranteed passage through Mexico. They fear if they set out in small groups without proper documentation, they'll be arrested or sent back to Guatemala. Immigration authorities here had been issuing African migrants travel documents until this summer. They stopped under pressure from the Trump administration. Henry, a migrant from Cameroon who won't give his last name out of fear of retribution, says he had to flee his village as soldiers attacked them last October. He says he got separated from his family and spent months looking for them, sneaking back into Cameroon from neighboring Nigeria several times.
I was traumatized because I kept thinking, where are they? Are they alive? Are they dead?
He finally decided he had to flee for good and caught a plane to Ecuador. It took him several months walking through the jungle, taking buses, and paying off corrupt officials in 7 different countries before arriving in Mexico.
That was when the greatest problem started. Here was the worst.
He says Africans can't find work here in Mexico's poorest state. He says there are no jobs and racism against blacks is terrible. He was told he could only apply for asylum, something he says he won't do. Luis Garcia Villagran, a human rights activist, has taken on the Africans' cause and says under Mexican law, the migrants have a right to a humanitarian visa or residency. If immigration officials don't start legalizing these people, if they don't start giving them documents, then we will begin to march en masse from here on Tuesday, he says. The migrants say they feel safer in a large group. Activist Villagran says there are more than 4,000 Africans stuck in the city and says a mass march of migrants through Mexico will quickly recall images of last spring's migrant caravans, which caught the ire of President Trump, something Mexican authorities want to avoid. Mexican immigration officials denied NPR's request for an interview. In a press release today, they say they will begin providing documents to the Africans, but didn't say what brought about the change in policy. For the Africans, though, it's unclear what fate awaits them, even if they do make it to the U.S. southern border. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that migrants could be denied asylum if they hadn't requested protection in a country they first passed through. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Mexico City.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now?
Germany has described yesterday's shooting outside a synagogue in the eastern German town of Halle that left 2 dead as an anti-Semitic attack. Here's NPR's Rob Schmitz.
Video taken from a bystander shows a man dressed in navy blue fatigues shooting a modified shotgun from behind a Volkswagen. This was not the only video of the attack. The shooter, identified by authorities as a 27-year-old German citizen, streamed video of himself with a head-mounted camera, a chilling echo of the mosque shooting earlier this year in the New Zealand city of Christchurch. He also posted a racist screed before launching the attack. A man who only gave NPR his surname, Friedrich, said he was pulling up to the bakery he works at when he saw the shooting.
He shot at many people, and then he threw multiple explosives over the wall of the synagogue.
There were nearly 80 worshippers inside observing Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement. Witnesses inside said the shooter tried to blast through the door, but that it held. Unable to shoot people inside, the man instead killed a woman outside the synagogue and a man at a nearby kebab shop. German police later arrested the suspect on a highway outside of town. Germany is watched with alarm as anti-Semitic crimes have risen by 20% last year alone, with 9 out of 10 cases blamed on far-right groups. This attack comes 3 months after a known neo-Nazi assassinated a politician who stood up for the rights of migrants. Germany's interior minister says the rising danger of the country's far right is as big a threat as radical Islam. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
But if I was white, I'd be better off. Isn't that true?
How do you talk to your kids about race, about ethnicity, gender, religion, or class? Those conversations can be hard. For the past year, NPR and the team behind Sesame Street have been collaborating on a podcast for parents. It's part of NPR's Life Kit. And today, Sesame Workshop is releasing the results of a new survey of parents about how they talk about social identity. Here's NPR's Corey Turner.
The short answer is a majority of parents hardly ever talk about social identity with their kids, according to this nationally representative survey of some 6,000 parents, done in collaboration with NORC at the University of Chicago. And the folks at Sesame Workshop say that's a problem because children do notice differences and they ask about them.
Why is this person darker than me? Why is this person wearing that hat on their head?
Tanya Hader is Executive Vice President for Research at Sesame Workshop, and she says parents too often respond to these questions with embarrassment and a shush.
We sometimes are scared to talk about these things. If the adults stiffen up and say, oh, you shouldn't say that loudly, that's sending them a cue that there's something wrong. And there's nothing wrong.
The vast majority of parents surveyed said they do feel comfortable talking about social identity. They just don't do it. That doesn't surprise Beverly Daniel Tatum. She's a psychologist and author of the classic, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria?
My guess is that some parents, certain majority parents, might think, what's to talk about? You know, maybe there's a sense of it doesn't really need to be talked about.
With many communities still segregated in so many ways, parents often see only families that share their social categories. There's another explanation, though. According to the survey, when parents do talk about social identity, they often wait till their kids are 10, 11, 12 years old. Jennifer Kotler-Clark, who oversaw the Sesame survey, says parents seem to think younger kids don't notice these differences.
There's all sorts of research to suggest that children very early on notice definitely physical differences, and there's discrimination very early on.
How early do kids notice differences? Try 6 months old. That's why Kotler-Clark says grown-ups need to be proactive. Kids need help making sense of the differences they see, and if they don't get it from parents,
they may come up with all sorts of weird and strange reasons that people are somewhat different.
Exhibit A, Beverly Daniel Tatum still remembers the day her 3-year-old son was told by a white preschool classmate,
your skin is brown because you drink chocolate milk. And then my son came home and asked me if that was true.
And this highlights a big warning sign in Sesame's new survey. Many of the parents who are talking about race, ethnicity, gender, class, or religion with their kids are doing so because they feel they have to. Because their kids are hearing negative comments about their own identities. And that, says Sesame's Tanya Hader, is a problem.
It's not the role or responsibility of a group of parents to be having those conversations. It really is the responsibility of everyone.
Conversation is key, Sesame says, to building your child's own positive sense of identity, along with a healthy respect for everyone else's. Corey Turner, NPR News.
Canada. We should move to Canada.
Ms. DeFelice, what did your survey find?
Well, our survey found that 1.2 million Ontario drivers have at some point driven high after consuming cannabis, and 72% report they wait 3 hours or less to get behind the wheel, and even 27% of those feel that they were very high or somewhat high when they did.
How long should they be waiting before driving?
Well, that's a good question. I think everyone's looking for that magic answer as to how long should they wait, because in our minds we have that, you know, one drink of alcohol per hour roughly, but, you know, cannabis is a bit of a different substance. And some of the research that we've done other than this particular study showed that even a joint, smoking a joint, even up to 5 hours afterward, there could be effects felt of impairment or lack of, you know, depth perception and things that are skills needed for driving.
Edibles will soon become legal. Is that a concern for you?
Yes. Edibles react in your body very different than smoking or vaping cannabis. And I think that there's some misunderstanding about that in sort of in the general marketplace. It can take up to 1, 2, or 3 hours for you to feel the effects of consuming cannabis by edibles. And so this could also have a profound impact on when people are driving after consuming edibles, what they're feeling, or when they may potentially all of a sudden realize that full high from consuming it that way. Plus, we have more people who have never tried cannabis in their lives are suggesting that they may be more willing to try it in an edible format. So 12% of our respondents said that they were considering trying, very likely or somewhat likely to try it after it's legalized.
What are your concerns about that?
Well, again, there's two things. It's people who don't have an understanding of the difference of how it impacts you. And so when people consume edibles, it could be that if they're not feeling the effects of getting high like they thought they would, they could then consume more, thinking that it's just a matter of they didn't eat the right quantity or the right amount. And then depending on what they do after that, could they be feeling a much harsher effect afterwards? The other thing then is you also have people who are just aren't experienced at what that high feels like and sort of what their reactions could be, both from the edibles itself, but if they're mixing, you know, important things like driving and consuming cannabis that way.
What, in your view, needs to be done about this?
So the study also said that people are very concerned about road safety and road safety for themselves and their loved ones. Public education was a key component. 74% felt that education on cannabis impaired driving laws and just understanding how cannabis affects you in the different formats needs to be a priority. And so that is something that we definitely want to hone in on. And the reality, too, that people are still somewhat unfamiliar of what the fines and penalties are and how police enforce looking for impaired driving by cannabis.
Thank you very much for this.
My pleasure.
Okay, I'm getting weeded now. I know I contradicted myself. Look, I don't need that now. It's just once in the blue when there's nothing to do. When the tension gets too thick for my sober mind to cut through. I get the zone in. Me and the chick on the island and we're boning. I free my mind. Sometimes I hear myself moaning. Take one more toke, then I leave that weed alone, man. It got me going. Shit.
Feeling it. Feel the glass.
I'm feeling it.
Throw the high that you get from the line. If you feel it, raise it all in the sky.
It's WGBH's Morning Edition. The first marijuana store approved under the state's Economic Empowerment Program is slated to open in Boston. While city officials are celebrating, neighbors are pushing back. From our Dorchester Bureau, WGBH Radio's Soraya Wintersmith reports the store is moving forward despite the opposition.
When Mike Kozu walks around Grove Hall, he sees a neighborhood in recovery.
Yeah, so this is clearly much different. There was a lot more violence that was going on that was drug-related, crack-related.
Kozu has been advocating in this neighborhood on the border of Dorchester and Roxbury for almost 40 years, most recently as co-director of the nonprofit Project Right. As he walks along Blue Hill Ave, he points to once empty spaces now filled. He says they are signs of revival happening here.
In the 80s and 90s, there are a lot of vacant lots. Some of this is being built back up now. So now you have a lot of traffic going on here. This is becoming more of a thriving community.
But less than half a mile away from his office, there's a building where Kozu and others would rather not see a new business open. Pure Oasis is soon to be the area's first recreational marijuana dispensary. It's also the state's first, intended to benefit an owner and a neighborhood harmed by past drug laws. Kozu lived through that era. He's afraid the shop would do more harm to the neighborhood.
Well, it takes us in a different direction. It sends the wrong message to young people. Much like the tobacco industry, much like smoke shops, much like liquor stores, a marijuana shop, to me, leads us down the same wrong path.
This is going to be the first economic empowerment-owned business in the entire state. Boston's very proud of that.
That's Alexis Kachuk, director of the Office of Emerging Industries. She signs the required agreements with dispensary owners on Boston's behalf. Kozu and others have additional concerns about the shop, like whether it's too close to Jeremiah Burke High School and whether the city rushed its approval. But Kachuk and other city officials say the celebrated shop meets the required conditions for siting. And even though public opinion is a factor, it's not enough to block the placement of a dispensary.
Perhaps it is the appropriateness of site, parking, public safety, what would appear to be lack of a willingness to converse with the community. It just couldn't be, we don't want a dispensary here.
Kachuk says her office has rejected three proposals where neighbors and city officials had specific concerns. That's not the case with the Equity applicant now poised to open in Grove Hall.
The fact that I am the first and not the 10th is more indicative of progress that still needs to be made in the city and in the state.
Inside the cavernous building of where his shop will be, dispensary co-owner Kobe Evans explains his view that equity should stay a top concern for the city.
Some people may say that justice is the right word. I just think that those who are locked up for the drugs shouldn't be locked out of the process of legalization and benefiting from the business opportunities that are created from that.
As for community support, he echoes the response city officials give. It's nice, but at this point, not necessary.
The support for our dispensary came in November of 2016 when people voted and said, yes, we want cannabis in our communities.
Mike Kozu disagrees. He says he'll continue to challenge the dispensary location for the good of the community.
The tobacco industry kept saying, oh, no, everything's fine. But we had to kind of push back on them and on the alcohol industry as well. And I think likewise we'll have to do this with marijuana.
Kobe Evans projects his shop will open sometime next month. In the Dorchester Bureau, Saraya Wintersmith, WGBH, Boston's local NPR.
You know what we vote for, airplanes bringing drugs into this country? The white man brings it in. The white man brings it to Harlem. The white man makes you a drug addict. The white man then puts you in jail when he catches you using drugs. Who is it that controls the prostitution in Harlem? It's the white man.
Drop me off in Harlem.
Now, an upcoming city council vote has residents of Harlem concerned about how a rezoning proposal might change the face of the neighborhood. Gothamist's Elizabeth Kim is reporting on that and joins me now. Hi, Liz. Thanks for coming down from the 8th floor to the 1st floor.
Thanks for having me.
You focus this primarily on Lenox Terrace. For people who don't know it, what is Lenox Terrace and what is some of its storied history?
So just to be clear, this particular rezoning would only affect Lenox Terrace, but it's a sprawling development. It basically goes from about 132nd Street to 135th Street, and it's also a storied complex in Harlem. It opened in the late 50s. It was billed as the first luxury apartment complex in Harlem. It had things like gold-braided doormen, these terraces where you had these sweeping views of New York City. There were porters. So there was a real sense that this was kind of a very unique place to be in Harlem, and it was exclusive.
But a lot of regular people live there and some people who everybody would have heard of?
Right. So over the years, it started out with a lot of very well-heeled professionals. There were the elites from Harlem's political and creative classes. Charles Rangel lived there. He still lives there. Basil Patterson, his son, the former governor, David Patterson, still lives there. And over the years, it's a huge complex. There are roughly 4,000 residents, and it became this kind of motley assortment of interesting people from, the very wealthy to working class people.
Now, you call the proposed plan that requires the rezoning a massive infill project. Can you describe it?
So an infill project basically takes a piece of property, and it basically looks at where there is empty space. And because the way this was constructed, it was constructed at a time when apartment complexes, to be a luxury apartment complex, you had to have parking spaces. So there are a lot of parking spaces at this complex. There's a lot of green space at this parking complex. And also there are areas around the corners which are still undeveloped and which they could insert these 28-story towers, which is what the owner is proposing.
5 28-story towers.
Yes.
And that's where the rezoning comes in. They're not allowed to do that as the zoning stands.
Right. And that's on top of the buildings that are already there. They have, I think it's six 17-story buildings that are existing.
So who's concerned about this?
So the residents are very concerned about this because, one, the construction has been estimated to take as long as 7 years. I mean, it could very well take more. There's going to be a lot of excavation. And also the way the project is constructed, it's going to be mostly market rate housing. There will be some affordable units, but, you know, people often question how affordable are those units going to be. But it's definitely a project that's meant to generate revenue. And their concern is that it has been a mostly rent-stabilized complex, but over the years, a lot of the units, about a third of them, are now market rate. And now you're going to build more market rate units. So you're basically turning this, what has been a bastion of affordability, into a market rate complex that will most likely be less black, more white.
The numbers that I think I got right from your piece is 1,600 units, 400 of them below market rate or, quote, affordable. So 400 new affordable units, that's 400 new affordable units. But it's also 1,200 at market rate being added as a percentage to the neighborhood.
Right.
And since your headline is "In Harlem, a rezoning plan triggers fears about the end of a black oasis," is the oasis only Lenox Terrace, or are residents concerned about Harlem in a broader sense?
That's exactly the case. I mean, the more you think about it, it's very emblematic about what's been happening, not just to Harlem, but to a lot of other neighborhoods across the city with gentrification. But there's something about Harlem, because it has long been considered the black capital of the world, in which I think there's a deeper sense of anxiety and angst over what this rezoning will do. You know, they've seen the changes sweep across other sections. I mean, if you walk, you know, it's within a few blocks of 125th Street, and you really see the dramatic changes that have gone along that commercial corridor. And to a lot of people, what this says is it looks less like Harlem. And more importantly, they're looking at the demographics. Will Harlem still be black? Will Harlem still be a place for black people? I interviewed one person who actually moved there recently, but he told me that he moved to Harlem because he wants to be in a place where people love black people. And there is this growing fear that is Harlem going to change in a way in which it's no longer going to have this historic identity as a kind of an epicenter of black culture?
Where's the mayor on this?
So it hasn't gotten to that point yet. It's still so early in the rezoning process. But, you know, the tenants were really worried earlier in the year when they saw that the developer or the owner, the Olnick organization, had hired James Capolino because he's the city's top lobbyist. And, you know, as been well reported, he has close ties with Mayor de Blasio. So they're very nervous. I mean, the most decisive, I guess, vote would be that of the local city council member.
And that's usually the case.
Yeah.
Rezonings are up to the council member from
right.
the area, basically, and the rest of council goes along. Who's the council member again?
Bill Perkins. So he hasn't said anything yet, and that also makes the residents extremely nervous.
So what's the news hook? There's a council hearing coming up or an actual vote?
There's going to be a vote by the local community board. Community Board 10, their land use committee, they held a hearing last month, and now they're expected to vote on it. So it's kind of just, it's going to grind its way through the process, which will take probably months.
Elizabeth Kim does great reporting on development and related issues for Gothamist, our Gothamist website, where she is a senior editor and reporter. Please thank Elizabeth Kim.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live in the green space. More to come.
When you don't vote, you can't sit on a jury. You have no right to complain about the police because you won't even go and vote so you can even sit on a jury. As I've told, said to the cows when I first started to call in, I spent 11 years on a job where I worked for a bank and had to sit in court day after day, day after day. And I watched them select juries. I watched black people going to jail, black people having white probation officers, and the whole judicial system just truncated with white supremacy. And a great deal of it is could be lessened if black people simply voted.
21-year-old DeAndre Somerville learned the hard way why you can't miss jury duty.
After going through that, it's like my life will never be the same again.
In August, he was sworn in as a juror on a civil case. He was to return the next day for trial, but he overslept.
I woke up and I looked at the time, and I was like, oh shoot, it's past the time.
Mistake number two, he didn't call the jury office to let them know what was going on. Days later, he was served with a subpoena to go before the judge.
I talked with my granddad for a while, and he said, the best thing you can always do is honesty. So I went for the hearing.
DeAndre lives with his grandparents and helps look after his grandfather by taking him to therapy.
My grandma was saying, oh, I think you should dress up. And I was like, nah, I'm gonna wear my work clothes because I feel like at least he can see that I'm doing something. Because a lot of times people get stereotyped. Oh, he's just another black boy out here doing something he's not supposed to be doing.
But the 21-year-old didn't see what was coming.
I just said, sir, I honestly overslept and I didn't understand the seriousness of this. He asked me if I had a criminal record. I said, sir, I've never been arrested.
Transcripts show DeAndre apologized, but the judge sentenced him to 10 days in jail. DeAndre said all he could think about was his grandfather.
He depended on me. So it was like, you know, it's hard for him.
Judge John Castronakis' order said DeAndre's failure to appear delayed the trial by 45 minutes, and the court couldn't reach him. WPTV's criminal analyst Michelle Suskauer says these cases are not common.
This is going to show others you have to take this very seriously. But this 21-year-old with no prior record now has a misdemeanor conviction. Could there have been other alternatives to maybe be more instructive and less punitive? It's possible.
It hurts, but it's like it's a lesson learned. It could have been worse.
When you discuss your love for lust, just make sure you visit here first, Cali. You might catch me in Atlanta.
What do police searches of blacks and Latinos reveal about racial disparities? The results of an analysis by the Los Angeles Times are troubling. It found that Los Angeles police officers search blacks and Latinos far more than whites during traffic stops. And that is despite the fact that officers are more likely to find illegal items on white residents. Cindy Chang covers the Los Angeles Police Department for the LA Times, and she co-authored this report and joins us now. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Rachel.
Can you give us a sense of how comprehensive the study was? How much data did you review?
It's 10 months of data. It's over 300,000 stops. It's every single stop that Los Angeles police officers made during that time period.
Wow. So that's a lot of statistics to work with. Can you get into the specifics? What do the numbers say?
So what we found was that 24% of African-American drivers and passengers were searched, compared with 16% of Latinos and 5% of whites. So that means that a black person who's traveling in a vehicle in the city of Los Angeles was more than four times as likely to be searched by the police as a white person, and a Latino was three times as likely.
Yet whites were found to actually have illicit items on them?
More often, in 20% of searches, compared with 17% for blacks and 16% for Latinos.
And you point out that you look at this and on the face of it, you think it must be racially motivated or that that must be some component. But you're reporting in the story, you say these racial disparities in search rates do not necessarily indicate bias.
It's not racism.
So explain that tension.
So you can't get into the mind of an individual officer in an individual traffic stop when you're looking at this aggregate data.
Right. You can't know intent.
Right. But when you see such disparities in the data, it at least, you know, it raises the questions of what's going on. And it is true that in Los Angeles, particularly in the parts of Los Angeles that have the most violent crime, most of the residents are Black and Latino, and most of the people who commit the crimes and who are the victims of the crimes are Black and Latino. But the criminologists really point to that contraband finding to question why it is that people of those races would be searched more often.
What has the response been from the LAPD to this?
Our story was published online Tuesday morning, and it so happened that the police commission met a few hours after that, and Police Chief Michael Moore came out and he said that they understand the disparate impact on the community. And that's one thing that the numbers do show, right? It shows that a lot of Black and Latino residents are not only being pulled over, but being searched, and they are also being asked to step out of the car, being handcuffed, being detained at the curb far more often than whites. So there is that impact, whether or not there is a good law enforcement reason for it. So the chief was saying that there's a troubled history of race relations in Los Angeles and that they need to address this issue. Now, when we came out with our study of the racial breakdowns of who is stopped at the beginning of the year, the mayor had already called for the LAPD to scale back on stopping drivers.
To stop traffic stops on the whole, to reduce the number of all traffic stops?
Right. And that has indeed happened. The number of stops is down 11%. And metro stops are down by 45%. So the chief was saying he's going to continue those efforts.
Cindy Chang covers the Los Angeles Police Department for the LA Times. Thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks, Rachel.
You know, first ladies usually have a cause. And you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt. And we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
When President Trump holds a campaign rally today in Minneapolis, Minnesota, he will be inside the congressional district of a lawmaker he often criticizes. It is the district of Democrat Ilhan Omar. NPR's Aisha Roscoe has been looking at the president's Twitter feed, where he has criticized Omar, among many other people. She found the president's attacks on lawmakers are growing more personal, especially against people of color.
President Trump's tweets can set the wheels of government in motion and set the tone for his supporters. Back in July, Trump was eagerly attacking Ilhan Omar at a rally in Greenville, North Carolina.
Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
In response, the crowd chanted, "Send her back."
Send her back. Send her back.
Omar was born in Somalia but is an American citizen. The chants were prompted by Trump's tweets a few days earlier. Using racist language, Trump tweeted that Omar and three other Democrats, all women of color, known as the Squad, should go back to the, quote, totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came. Trump has always used Twitter as a weapon against his political opponents. But these tweets, and the dozens that will come in the weeks following against the Squad and against African-American Congressman Elijah Cummings, represented an escalation of the president's attacks.
These are people that, in my opinion, hate our country.
And AOC plus three, that's what I call it.
Elijah Cummings has not helped the people.
If you're not happy here, then you can leave.
NPR examined Trump's tweets about members of Congress through October 4th. Since becoming president, Trump has tweeted more than 700 times about current lawmakers. While Trump hasn't been restrained about insults, his negative tweets have increased in volume, and the nature of insults have become more extreme since July. In the case of the Squad, which includes Omar, Ayanna Pressley, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Rashida Tlaib, Trump has tweeted about them collectively nearly 20 times in about 3 months. That's more negative tweets than Trump has aimed at presidential candidates Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. Among other things, he's called the Squad a very racist group of troublemakers. That language speaks to some white Trump supporters who may be worried about their place in America, says Niambi Carter. She's a political science professor at Howard University.
When he says make America great again and points to these women as the sort of embodiment of everything that America isn't. It's not black. It's not a woman. It's not Muslim. It's not Latina. These women become perfect vehicles for all of that anxiety that these white voters feel.
The only lawmakers with more negative tweets than the Squad and Cummings are top Democrats, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff. But his tweets about them are more general criticisms about the Democratic Party.
The president chooses his targets pretty carefully, but he doesn't always choose them for the same reason.
That's Brian Ott, a communications professor at Texas Tech University and co-author of The Twitter Presidency. He says Trump uses Twitter to discredit politicians he views as a threat and to distract from other matters.
Then there's this other motivation, which is trying to define the opposition. And it's clear that he takes tremendous pleasure and is particularly vitriolic when it comes to characterizing women and ethnic minorities on Twitter.
On Twitter, Trump says the face of the Democratic Party is the Squad, Pelosi, and Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who is African American. He never says white men are the face of the Democratic Party. The White House didn't respond to interview requests, but Trump's supporters argue he's a counterpuncher. Paris Denard is a prominent African-American conservative who backs Trump. He said it's not race or gender that motivates the president.
If you are a worthy opponent, meaning you have a large social media following, meaning you can attract a lot of people to whatever it is you're talking about, he's going to engage with them because he thinks it's worth the fight.
Trump has targeted both Cummings, who is chair of the House Oversight Committee, and Schiff with a flood of tweets. But while the tweets against Schiff have focused on his actions as chairman, Trump's tweets against Cummings focused on the mostly black district he represents in Baltimore. Ott says the rhetoric about Cummings in particular is meant to set him apart as different.
The president's discussion of Baltimore as rat infested is really meant to convey that he's not quite human.
With an impeachment probe in full swing, the president has tweeted about the Squad less. Cummings hasn't gotten a mention in weeks. But Trump hasn't forgotten about these lawmakers. He told reporters on Friday that AOC plus three, as he likes to call the Squad, are the real leaders of the Democratic Party. Aisha Roscoe, NPR News, Washington.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me.
That sentence was read just before noon. The judge could have given him up to 30 years. Instead, gave him 20 in this manslaughter death.
I'm going to sentence you to 20 years in the Department of Corrections.
Michael Draca showed no emotion as a judge read his 20-year prison sentence. In July of 2018, Draca shot and killed Marquise McLaughlin outside this convenience store in Clearwater. It happened after an argument with McLaughlin's wife involving a handicapped parking space. McLaughlin, who was unarmed, pushed Draca to the ground and Draca shot him.
Mr. McLaughlin attacked our client, but he did. It's a fact.
For the first time, McLaughlin's family addressed their loved one's killer. His father brought up what the Bible says about forgiving others.
At this point in my life, I am not there yet. And if just so happened that the Lord chooses to take me before I come to terms with this, then I will see you in hell. Well, you and I, we will finish this. Mark my words.
At first, Pinnell's deputies did not arrest Draca because of Florida's controversial Stand Your Ground law. After weeks of protests, the state attorney's office did file charges. Draca did not end up using a Stand Your Ground defense, instead letting the case go to a jury trial.
This case was historic. This case was precedent-setting because it showed that equal justice under the law is possible in America for black and brown people, too.
Draca will get credit for time that he's already spent in jail. We spoke to his attorneys, and they say they do plan to file an appeal within 30 days.
Now I really understand what they mean.
That man turning himself into police after the crash happened in Alliance.
Today he was in court for the first time. Stephen Hernandez was there. He's joining us now with the new details.
That's right. Jonathan Haydock faces multiple charges today, including the most glaring of which, aggravated menacing for saying racial slurs toward Jolene Daly. Today, Haydock pleaded not guilty to all charges. Daly says she wasn't just shaken by the not guilty pleas. She says this is the first time something like this has ever happened to her.
When I went to go and record him, that's the first time someone said something like that to me, or my life was threatened.
Is the man me? White power? Did you say white power to me?
Haydock looks menacing in this video, but in court, he was remorseful.
I just want my life back. I want my job back. I want to go back to work. I want to go see my daughter. I just want my life back.
But Daly was not having any of it.
He wanted his life back, but he was going to take my life. So, like, I was just like, he's probably had a moment to think about things. I don't know.
But since the video was posted on Facebook, Daly has also received a lot of support from her friends online.
A lot of folks sent private messages, like saying, please, you know, don't hold them accountable for his actions. But I'm not that type of person. You have to judge each person for themselves, not in clusters.
Now, Haydock is set to appear for pre-trial on August 16th at 10:30 a.m. And 19 News will be here to give you all of the updates. Reporting in Alliance, for 19 News, I'm Stephen Hernandez. To be
black. I want to get to a story that was in Florida politics. You can find this story. We're going to put it on our website, WFLANews.com. Just go to the PM Tampa Bay page. A Facebook video went viral out of St. Pete showing a middle-aged white woman shouting at a black teenager and calling him racist names. The video, posted by Facebook user Daisha Adriana, claims the unidentified boy is 14 years old and dropped a gum wrapper on the sidewalk, which he was going to pick up, until the woman started screaming at him on the sidewalk in front of Nature's Table on 3rd Street North across from Williams Park. Is anybody familiar with that area? I don't venture into St. Pete that much, so.
No, I can't.
You're our resident,
say that I
St.
am.
Pete.
Williams Park.
Mm. No? Okay.
Not super familiar with it, at least.
I'll Google map it while you read.
This one, according to Janelle Irwin, who put the story together, is a lot like Barbecue Becky. Barbecue Becky called the police on a group of African-American individuals having a barbecue at a park. And then there was Permit Patty, a woman who called the police over a black girl selling bottled water in front of her home. It was like a trend happening here. Although this is a little bit different because the incident is over what she seemed to think was littering, although it's not clear that's exactly what was happening because you've got the video. In the video, the boy is like walking up to the bushes where the woman's pointing, and then she starts going nuts on him, and that's when he just walks away. So he might have been going to pick up the guy. I don't know.
Yeah. It's hard to tell because the video starts kind of in the middle of the altercation.
But even if he was littering and just leaving a gum wrapper.
Oh, my God.
To go off like this. So we have the audio from the video. Here is the audio again of this woman in St. Pete, middle-aged white woman, shouting at a black teenager who dropped a gum wrapper on the sidewalk.
Nuh-uh, don't even act like that. Pick it up. Find it. Get it down on your knees and find it. Get down on your knees and find it.
Sit down.
No count, little. That's how you are. All y'all, no count. Walk around here acting like something.
And that was the N-word that we had to bleep out. And once she says all y'all and then the N-word, I mean, you clearly know where she's coming from. Yeah. It's not about a gum wrapper. Uh-uh. It's about a whole lot more than that. Janelle Irwin's idea for a name for this woman was Pick It Up Peggy. We don't know her name. We don't know her identity.
It's a good name, though.
I thought gum wrapper Gretchen. She looked like a Gretchen to me.
Okay.
Sidewalk Sally.
Yep. That's Litter Louise.
Litter Nazi Laura. Where's the location that this incident took place?
Just west of downtown.
Okay.
So it's like if you go east from Williams Park, you hit Straub Park, you hit the Museum of History. All along Bayshore Boulevard, Al Lang Stadium, so it's right in that area. It's right across from Janet's Landing.
Somebody litters. I have no problem pointing out, hey, you're going to pick that up. But that's not what this was about.
No.
And you could tell it's not what this was about because of the words that she uses, especially when she busts out the N-word, and the fact that she lumps in an entire group of people into the situation. That's the tell right there.
And get on your knees.
Yeah. That too. Because I find nothing more annoying than when I'm walking Stetson around my apartment complex and some jackass leaves. Usually it's like Chick-fil-A wrappers or we have a steak and shake that's right there and it'll be that. So like late, they're drunk, they come back late, and somehow the wrappers wind
just
up
on the
ground. It's very frustrating. But again, it's not about the littering here. Clearly, when you listen, let me play the audio one more time for everybody.
Nuh-uh, don't even act like that. Pick it up. Find it. Get down on your knees and find it. Get down on your knees and find it.
Sit
down. Oh, no. No count, little. That's how you are. All y'all. No count. Walk around here acting like something.
She's not just angry about gum wrappers.
Mm-hmm.
She's
clearly
angry.
Some other things on her mind.
Yeah.
She's angry in general. So we'll have that video for you, and we're going to have the story for you, too. WFLANews.com. Just go to the PM Tampa Bay page to check that out.
Dixie Classic Fair in North Carolina wraps up tomorrow, and it's the last year it will go by that name. City officials in Winston-Salem voted to rename the event because for some, Dixie evokes images of slavery and segregation. Carrie Brown with member station WFDD reports.
The Southern theme name has been part of the Dixie Classic Fair since 1956. The grandstand near its entrance is a popular spot for entertainment, but this year, it's getting even more attention.
They're going to have to paint the wall on the grandstand. It says Dixie Classic Fair. It's been there forever.
People are taking selfies underneath the vintage-looking sign. Nearby, a souvenir booth only has a few items left. Michael Gross drove all the way from New York just to say goodbye.
The name means, like, a lot. I mean, it's really heartbreaking. I mean, I think back to, like, my mom picking me up for half days of school because we have a cookie competition we have to get to and we have to do it. So, I mean, it is. It almost brings a tear to my eye, like, thinking that it's going to be different.
Fresh roasted, fresh squeezed.
Attendance and merchandise sales have been breaking records this year. The city of Winston-Salem took down a Confederate statue in March and then moved to rename this event. Tensions ran high during a public meeting on the issue. Thousands responded to a survey. Most people wanted to keep Dixie in the fair's name. But local resident Maya Gilliam says it needed a change.
It represents the Confederate flag. It represents white supremacy in general, the KKK. So I think it's important now that, you know, even though the world has grown, we still need to make sure the different symbols change as well because they hold energy.
The switch has been the talk of this year's fair, even for Pastor Willie Hawkins, who says the issue is complicated. Hawkins is black and says people are going overboard.
If you're going to get rid of the name of a fair because it's Dixie, the next thing you're going to get rid of them Dixie cups and Dixie plates, Mason-Dixon line, it's part of history. It has to stop somewhere.
Winston-Salem isn't the only community dealing with this. In Northern California, the Dixie School District Board voted this year to change the name of the 150-year-old school system. The term Dixie is synonymous with describing the geographic area of the South and was used in a song by the Confederacy during the Civil War.
In the South, the past is never dead. It's not even past. And how we memorialize and evoke the past is constantly a challenge.
That's Southern folklorist Bill Ferris. He says the word has evolved over time, and communities should embrace these healthy conversations. Back at the Dixie Classic Fair, Joshua Hostetter was with his 3-year-old son. He says visiting this place has been an annual tradition since he was a kid.
I'm going to miss it, it's to be honest, because it is what I grew up with, calling it the Dixie Classic Fair. And I feel like I can see both sides of things, being interracial and whatnot. So, but if it bothers some people, I don't want to be insensitive to the way people feel about things.
Hostetter says the change will be hard to get used to, but he's looking forward to making new memories with his family. What the fair will be called next year hasn't been decided. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Brown in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Said they're building a great big factory down in South Carolina, and the trains will roll across country with their cargo behind them, and they could take a million lives, my brother.
It's Live 5 News.
And about 10 years ago, as a young police officer, I attended a law enforcement Halloween party dressed as ruthless drug kingpin Big Meech Flannery. I did it to disparage a criminal whose actions hurt our community and country. That was a different time. Today, we understand that type of costume is troubling to many.
A candidate running for sheriff in Collin County posted this campaign video today where he shows that picture of himself in blackface.
That candidate is Craig Stivender, and now he's opening up about why he chose to use that photo.
Paula Tristan Aruda talked with him today, and he said this is an effort to be, I guess, more transparent.
Yeah, well, Stivender, he's running as a Republican, and he used this campaign video as an opportunity to show people that he's made mistakes and he's not perfect. He says one of those mistakes just happened to be at a Halloween party a decade ago.
I'm Craig Stivender. My family has called Colleton County home for over 200 years.
A law enforcement officer with 15 years' experience is now owning up to his mistakes in a new campaign video. Colleton County Sheriff candidate Craig Stivender released his video today ahead of the 2020 election. In it, he mentions a photo of him dressed as a black gang member for a Halloween party.
10 years ago, I went to a law enforcement Halloween party with a friend of mine who happens to be a black female who is pictured in our video. We went to the party. It was Halloween, and I dressed as a notorious gang member who was highly recognizable at the time. His name was Big Meech Flannery.
Stivender says he decided to be open and honest with the people at the start of the campaign, which included talking about things his opponents may try to use against him. He mentions getting a traffic ticket, losing his temper on the job, and the photo of him darkening his skin to look like the gang member.
So 10 years ago when I dressed up, I had no idea what blackface was. It just happened to be a Halloween costume for me. There was was nothing negative or racially motivated about it.
This year alone, the University of South Carolina and the Citadel both came under fire for blackface photos in their yearbooks. Stuyvesant hopes the photo won't define his character so he can focus on his platform to try and clean up Colleton County. He says he's also looking forward to working with President Trump to combat the threat of undocumented immigrants. But when I asked him if he apologizes for the photo...
Are you sorry about this photo?
So I will refer back to my video. What I would say is that it was never my intention to hurt anyone's feelings or make fun of anyone. It was just a Halloween costume.
Stuyvesant says he's open to having conversations with anyone who may have been offended by the video or the photo. Colleton County voters will decide their next sheriff in November of next year.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, October 12, 2019. So I have been told this is our weekly broadcast, the compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, counter-racist suggestions, news items, questions you'd like to submit. Feel free. The number 605-313-5164. The code 564-943. Pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Lots to share. Wow. Two tidbits I did want to make sure I share. I'll do one now and one as we proceed. Black self-respect. The grandsister, Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing, she was a guest on this program 31 times. Many times on this broadcast, and pretty much she had an opportunity to speak to any black person, any non-white person, period, she would emphasize the importance of black self-respect, saying that that is crucial, and saying that in order to maintain a system of white supremacy, white people have to annihilate black self-respect. She used to say black self-respect is more power, more powerful than a nuclear weapon. Black self-respect. And I bring that up because I think frequently we've talked about repeatedly wisdom of psychopaths. We've talked about how predators, the Jeffrey Epsteins of the known universe, they are very skilled at picking out vulnerable individuals. And I think one component of that is being able to pick out individuals where their black self-respect has been annihilated. Like, oh, wow, this person, you know, will allow themselves to be mistreated in any type of way, and they will not say anything or do anything at all to try to stop it. Black self-respect has been annihilated. Non-white person self-respect has been annihilated. Oh, wow. We talk about that on workplace racism a lot. Stopping things immediately. Just they'll start out small. It might be they mispronounce your name. But just do, you know, things to be discourteous. Smaller forms of mistreatment, and then it will become more intense, greater abuses. It just goes from there. We talk about this with sexual abuse a lot of times, too. A lot of times it'll just start with a remark or some sort of unwanted touching, and it just becomes more aggressive from there. Black self-respect. I think in male-female relationships, I think there are times where an individual, male or female, can pick out a partner. Oh, wow. Low self-esteem, low levels of black self-respect, I can really take advantage of that, this person. That is so important. Eliminating white supremacy racism is about eliminating mistreatment. That is so important. Really do things that support, nourish, and increase, bolster your black self-respect. Be mindful of people who do things, say things. The result of having contact with them is that you have reduced levels of black self-respect. That is really important. And in a system of white supremacy, there have to be lots of individuals like that because, as Dr. Welsing said, it is imperative to eliminate black self-respect. So be mindful of that. Be mindful of how people talk to you if they're not calling you by your correct name. Be mindful if people are wasting your time and energy. Just be really, really observant of that. Black self-respect is a crucial component of solving the problem. Moving forward. Cows, 2019 counter-racist yoga retreat. Speaking of black self-respect, I think eating correctly and exercising yoga, I think, is grand. But I mean, you can get in constructive exercise in many ways. Getting exercise, being able to eat correctly, taking care of yourself. Super important component of black self-respect, I think. I will take a quick side note here. Speaking of eating correctly, there was a book I saw this week. If I remember the title correctly, it was You Are What Your Grandparents Ate. I almost played it on the compensatory call-in, but I've said for years you can't play everything. I almost played a segment where they were talking about the book. And one component that stood out, it was many things, but they were saying, you know, for females, unless I've been misinformed, you have all of your eggs for reproductive purposes at birth. So what they were saying in this book is that the mom is pregnant. If you're having stressful events, that impacts not just the mom, that impacts the baby, and since you have all the eggs, that impacts the grandchild as well. All is present and getting whatever stress. Now, white supremacy racism. But the food component they were saying is, hey, if you are eating, if you're eating beets and apples and bananas and spinach and kale and leeks, you're getting blueberries, lots of fresh fruits, vegetables, nuts, drinking your water. Hey, the baby, your grandchild is getting all of that nourishment. Same side or the converse. You're eating Cheetos, Popeye's chicken sandwich, you know. That is not just one generation that is getting what they call junk food. That is three generations that are getting junk food. And Dr. Ruby Lathan, who I emailed this week because she said she'd be willing to do three visits a year or whatever so that we can make that a current component of counter-racist curriculum, thinking about eating correctly and, you know, giving us some of the new information. They just had the guidelines about red meat is not so bad. You can have that in your diet. We'll ask Dr. Lathan what she thinks about that. But you are what your grandparents ate. They talked quite a bit about food and how it does not just impact you. It does not just impact one generation, epigenetics, and a lot of concepts we've discussed before. So side note, black self-respect, very important component of the COWS 2019 Yoga Retreat, Florida, December 28th through January 1. We already had a number of folks, listeners, who signed up, hit the September 15 deadline, and we're ready to roll. Much obliged. Hopefully it will be worthy of your time and energy. We also had a number of listeners who said, hey, the ticketed price at $9.25, if there's any way you can make it more accessible, we would love to come and do some yoga and hang out in Florida, which was the whole point of me doing the retreats and wanting to be a yoga instructor in the first place, to make it more accessible to people who need yoga the most, like myself. I was able to search the housing in Florida for this time of year is expensive. That is the biggest cost for the retreat by far. I did some checking and was able to find substantially lower housing where we would still have all the amenities we had before. At the other location, it would still be in Florida next to the Orlando International Airport, approximately 35 minutes, give or take, you know, depending on traffic or whatever. But it'd be the same setup that was pictured that I've been talking about the whole time, where we will have beds, we will have yoga every day taught by Gus T, Chef Nadira flying in from Virginia to do plant-based meals every day. I think I might actually do a little bit of cooking. I talked about the peach cobbler before. It's not peach season, or it won't be peach season by the time we get to the end of December. So maybe an apple cobbler. I was just talking to a Cows listener, and I said pumpkin pie or sweet potato pie. If I have enough opportunities to do a couple trial runs and I'm able to bake and it comes out great, either of the pies, I will do a pie. I will do a little bit of cooking at the retreat. Chef Nadira is holding it down in the kitchen. She did a superb job in Virginia, so I'll be looking forward to eating her offerings. But I will do one bit of cooking, just because I think it's important. There's so many reasons to eat healthy. You are what your grandparents ate. There are so many reasons to try to eat as well as you possibly can. Make that a daily component, that right there, making sure that racists do not get opportunities to put food on your plate, minimizing their impact and the damage that they do, the terrorism that they wreak on Black people, right there with the Cheetos and Popeye's chicken sandwiches and the like. But the cost for the retreat reduced by $200, was able to get the price down to $730 to make it more accessible and can give folks. I do want to try and hop on that before, you know, things get booked out and other folks say, hey, being in Florida for December does sound like an intelligent thing to do. So $730 and still breaking it up so that, you know, doesn't have to be all at once. The first for the folks left, you still want to take up the few spots that are left, and everybody's paying the same price. So the folks who already paid their deposit, it'll just be reduced from the second payment. Everybody paying the same price will all have the $730 price for the retreat. But to make it more accessible, if $730 helps, you can have the $380, roughly half, $380. Deposit is due by October 24th. About 2 weeks from now, and then the final $305 is due at the first part of December. But yeah, looking forward to the retreat. And if you have any questions, the details are posted on my blog. You can check that out, but you can drop an email if you have any questions, concerns, any details, but it's pretty much everything is the same. Just able to find a location that is a little bit cheaper. The dates again, December 28th through January 1, starting out the new year in a constructive manner. That is the plan. With that, let's see, going down my list. The report on parents not wanting to talk to their children, I thought that was important for many reasons. It reminded me of justice. I think we've tried to emphasize the importance of Black parents talking to their offspring since the inception of the Cows, I think. That's in the archives. You can, you know, check us to see if that's accurate. But having justice here at 10 and really emphasizing that is a core component of being an attempted parent, talking to your children or any other younger non-white people, if you have access to them, to be talking about these issues in a serious and accurate manner so that they are not confused and they understand the problems that we face as victims of racism, white supremacy. talking to your offspring talking to your offspring and the number of white guests. I almost found one of the sound clips because we've had a number of white guests who've been on the program who have talked about either they talk to their children, their white offspring, about racism, or they have talked about how their white parents talked to them about racism, white supremacy, informed, educated them about how to function and what it means to be classified as a white man, white woman. Even Farrell Winfrey, going all the way back to the beginning of the cows, talked about that in detail. Her mom was more refined. Her dad was more explicit in talking about the Negras, and his mom, she was a bit more codified in the way that she practiced and informed them about white supremacy, racism. But it's all the same, just, you know, different methods. They do a lot of that. But talking to your children, and I thought in that segment specifically where they said majority parents, there are lots of ways where we obfuscate from talking about the problem, whites. In my view, all of that produces confusion. And all of that is a symptom of white supremacy, racism. I think I said, it was last week, I said there's so many black people, so many victims of racism who have been killed for just talking about racism. I contend that right there, not even being able to speak directly to the problem, white people. We got to use all of these confusing, deliberately confounding terms, majority parents. And then you come around today. I just saw on one of the Seattle public radio outlets, they had this long report on SeaTac. It's right down the road next to the Seattle airport. It's maybe 15 minutes outside of Seattle. That they're having this big problem because they have a what they called majority minority community, but they are not in power. The people that are in power at SeaTac are all white men. That was just there. So how do you have a majority minority and then say majority parents? Be exact, direct. That's part of the compensatory call-in. Let's see. And within that same report, I don't think white children are hearing negative remarks about white people. I could be wrong, but I don't think that's the case. Next, they called Harlem a black oasis. I don't know what that means, like, at all. I don't even have a guess as to what that means, an area that whites have allowed black people to stay. And now it seems that they might be revoking that allowance and dislocating them to another region. That's a lot of that happening around the world. But oasis, no idea what that means. And they even said within the report that there were individuals, presumably black, who moved to Harlem because they wanted to be in an area where black people are loved. Wow. I've been to New York before, New York City and other parts. Wow. I am not sure that I felt like when I arrived, like I'm loved because I'm classified as black. I do not remember that feeling. Maybe I didn't go to the correct region of Harlem. If Thomas in New York or any other New York listeners, if you can let us know when that time period was, if you lived in Harlem, when, wow, this was a place where if you were a black person, you knew that you are loved because you are black in this part of Harlem. If you could let us know, that would be grand. The segment where the black male, he overslept, he was late for jury duty. I guess he didn't call or what have you. And he got 10 days of prison time for missing this. They did say they had a different report later that said that they had a change of heart and allowed him to get out of this jail time. That being said, black boy, he referred to himself as a black boy and he's 21. I thought that was the man, not Dr. Curry, reminded me of Dr. Welsing, but just everything around it. With no criminal record, no anything, and oversleeping results in him being a convict. Got to teach him a lot. What did they say when I think it was a black male who calls in from Florida at the courthouse? He said it was some black boys, young children, they came to the courthouse. And it wasn't, oh, let's get them some ice cream and we can have it. It was, no. Let's take them to the court so the judge can talk to them about responsibility. And it's going to be repercussions for your actions. Why is that the way? Black people, it's always got to be something punitive. Like, it doesn't matter what you did. You dropped a gum wrapper. You overslept. Punitive. Lashes. Floggings. Like, we don't do lenience. Throw one of those metaphors on you. Spare the rod. Continuing. I did insert when they had the report on the Los Angeles Police Department, and they had the information that black motorists, I think they used the tacky phrasing, black and brown motorists are stopped more. I laughed heartily. Because I've contended for years that whites are not ignorant about white supremacy racism, and they're not ignorant about police terrorism of black people worldwide. I would even evidence James Lowen's Sundown Towns, where he talked about that was an expectation. I highlighted it, that the enforcement officers would terrorize and molest black people, especially if they came into a predominantly white area where it's not supposed to be niggers around anyway, that you had better, if you're going to have that badge on, you had better get that nigger knocker and, you know, get the pride in those niggers once they cross the city limits. Next, but that was why I put the laugh track in. That's that white people just found this out. They had to do this study that probably cost $10,000 to get data that, oh yes, the niggers are being stopped more. The black and brown people, excuse me, that's what they said. Next. The squad just sounds like such a tacky nickname if we're talking about, like, members of Congress. I mean, if we're talking about, like, elected officials, AOC, I don't even like that. I mean, it just sounds like a tacky name. We talk about that workplace racism all the time. Are you talking about a gang of hooligans, the squad? Like, is this a rap group? Like, what in the world? I'm not aware of other members of Congress, the Senate, the Supreme Court, any, you know, body of government, even if we were talking, you know, local state government. I'm just not aware of those type of names being used to describe, like, these are lawmakers of the country, and they're just being talked about, like I said, like a rap group or a gang. Context of white supremacy. Continuing, when they got to the segment about the gum wrapper and the young 14-year-old black child, and he was terrorized by this white woman, who again did not seem like she was fearful. We got a young black hooligan, potential rapist, out on the streets of Florida. Where is George Zimmerman when you need him? And she was not fearful. She didn't run in the house. She didn't call 911. I got this nigga right here. You're going to pick that. You're going to get on your knees right now. That's what she told him. When they read that report, the local Florida station, they referenced those other instances where they do actually have the identity of the race soldiers in those cases, where the white woman at the pool and the white woman who came for the bottled water, all those individuals got identified. We said months ago, when these incidents happened, that is another act of racism, getting these little tacky names, Permit Patty and such, to label these acts of racism. One, you're not even correctly identifying the white person. That anonymity is consistent with helping perpetuate the system of racism. But then when you put these little names on it, it makes it sound like kind of a trivial, jokey type of a thing. Permit Patty, I mean, are you talking about a cartoon? Is this a kid's show? What are you talking about? It does not make it at all sound like you're talking about a serious act of racism. And this Gretchen gum wrapper and all the, again, it makes it sound like this is a child's nursery rhyme, not an act of racism. And we just had that segment last week where they were talking about traumatic events that happen to children that can stay with you for a life. Toni Morrison talks about that in her books that we're wrapping up. He was 14. You're still a child, I think, even by law. You're still a child at 14. This sort of incident, I'm just walking down the street. Maybe he didn't even drop a piece of paper. Who knows? He's been accused, but okay, let's say he dropped a piece of paper, a gum wrapper, and this happens. Wow. Didn't I just talk about black self-respect? Now, how do you go to school? How do you function? 14 years old, I drop a piece of paper and I end up being terrorized and called a nigger. And this is representative of what is bad about niggers in general. Now I'm supposed to go to school and be an all-star, be on the honor roll, be class president, go be all I can be, maybe go attend Florida State, University of Florida, be grand. Next. The set were within that same segment when they're saying, oh, yeah, this is an act of racism. And she had, you know, more. It wasn't just about the rapper. When the male announcer, when he said there are incidents in my parking lot, the people are drunk, they come in and a lot of times it'll be a fried chicken wrapper. That was the first example. And then he went to, you know, they've been drinking or whatever it is. And I just thought, wow, we're talking about this incident of racism and the first thing, somehow fried chicken gets mentioned. Maybe I have heard too many racist fried chicken jokes in a lifetime. That is very possible. There are a lot of fried chicken jokes about black people, but I found that curious that within that segment, talking about a black person being terrorized for racism, and somehow this gets to people leaving fried chicken wrappers on the ground. Anywho, I'll get to the rest later. For this broadcast, I do request specifically if we could take 5 minutes to share whatever thoughts, questions, comments you have. If you need more than five, if you can wait till everyone has spoken at least once, then you can return and add your additional feedback. That would be great. Just making sure everyone has at least one chance to speak. And if we could not use metaphors, that would be spectacular. Race soldiers, no one does it better. Using metaphors to deliberately confuse what white supremacy racism is. We heard race relations. That is a super tacky metaphor used. James Lowen uses that a lot in his book as well. That all of that is deception. All of that is obfuscating. That's the same thing majority parents. None of that is about producing justice and by revealing truth. Race soldiers, one of their main tactics, they'll take these metaphors, similes, comparisons, analogies. They'll take two concepts and say these are identical. They're exactly alike. LGBT, so-called civil rights. They'll say it's exactly alike. Frequently, it is not at all. They'll be comparing two completely separate entities, master deceivers. Victims of racism, including myself, we have been exposed to this misconduct for centuries. And many of us, myself included, we have not come to conclusions on some subjects, which is fine. However, in these instances, sometimes we don't have logic to articulate our views. And so sometimes we'll rely on an analogy, metaphor of some sort. And frequently this just adds confusion. If we could be direct, exact about what we want to say, I would appreciate it. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. The other quick detail I was going to add, they've had so much talk, Greta Thunberg and all the rest, Thornburg, all the rest about climate change. Got to do something about this. We've had all these hurricanes and enormous weather problems, the wildfires down in California. Hope safety to any of the Cal's listeners who are California residents. As a resident of Seattle, I should be super concerned about climate change. There is an active volcano less than 100 yards from Seattle, Mount St. Helens. I've actually, in flying into Seattle, have been on a plane where the pilot said, oh, look, Mount St. Helens is smoking. You can see it. Look out the window right now. Active volcano, and they actually have volcano evacuation routes posted. I've never been anywhere in the planet. Not that I've done that much traveling, but I've never been anywhere where I've seen volcanic eruption routes and warning signs like posted on the road in case there is an eruption of some sort, like I even spent, you know, a sizable amount of time in Hawaii, and I don't remember them having volcano eruption routes posted by the side of the road. But they have that here, in addition to quite a bit of worry about earthquakes, in addition to, I guess, California having major fault lines. They have major fault lines in Seattle, and they regularly talk about, you know, trying to make sure the buildings downtown are fitted and prepared for earthquakes and a big one is going to hit and what type of damage it could do and that sort of thing. Seattle is very close to the water, so they obviously worry about what they call rising sea levels. I think they have a number of levee systems here because Seattle is on the water, that they have a number of bad levees reminiscent of New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina. So people that live here, including Gus T, should be very concerned about climate change for a myriad of reasons. That is not on my list of priorities. It remains the system of white supremacy, volcano notwithstanding. The number again is 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Grant, I think I did make one error. The Cows Yoga Retreat, the price is dropped to $730. That is the total price. The deposit, $380, due by October 24th. And then the final installment is $370. That was it. Final installment is $370. That is the total price of $730. If you have questions, need additional info, untiljustice@gmail.com. Folks who dialed in, if you have questions, observations, thoughts to share, feel free. I think so-called Columbus Day is approaching. I think they do celebrate that in a number of places. I'm not sure if anyone will be impacted. I know they do close some buildings. I think the mail even stops running in some locales for that. So you can share a thought if that's happening. I think they are trying to get rid of that in some areas as well. I know there was talk of that in Washington State and having Indigenous Peoples Day. That's what it's called. Yeah. Anywho, folks who dialed in, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments, questions to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Irie, aforementioned New Orleans. Good to hear from you.
Oh, no, this is Draptomania.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. Thanks for taking my call, Gus. Hello to the listeners and the callers. The clips were quite interesting, very informative. I had some thoughts on it, but I wanted to basically just give you an update on my housing situation. And I would like to also thank you for making a comment regarding Black self-respect. That was very encouraging. That was a theme that I have been implementing and using to boost my self-esteem and to not allow myself to be mistreated anymore like I have in the past. As far as my housing situation, I was talking on a show about how I had dealt with some situations with a harassment situation with one of the tenants here. I discussed also how I have been going through some with the noise issue, with the constant noise and banging. And then I also discussed the situation with the internet service. So these were situations that were going on congruently. They back to back to back. So I suspect because my landlord is a white supremacist suspect, and I suspect that based on the evidence and things that I'm seeing, that these things are is basically being done intentionally. There's been some unjust networking, and I'm seeing how you know, they have been doing some unjust networking and basically just, you know, getting together and, you know, gossiping and, you know, making, you know, making me the, I guess, the bad guy where, you know, anybody that moves in, you know, they can basically just, I guess, just, you know, bad mouth you and gossip and say whatever they want to say about you to make you look like, you know, you're not a good person or what have you. And then what they do, they get the their tenants or whoever, you know, like they do on workplace racism, how you get the different they get their different coworkers to basically harass you by proxy. So what she ended up doing, so this is the situation of things that were going on, and I suspect that based on the evidence and based on what I've been observing, that was the case with the guy that was harassing me. It wasn't being done. It was being done on because he was being prompted to do so, and I think it was due to you know, he was, you know, they were doing the unjust networking thing. So yesterday, with the situation with the cable, no, with the internet service, I had some black self-respect, and I stood up for myself, and I explained to them that, you know, about the internet, I kept on getting interrupted. I talked about that on this program, and what I ended up doing, I had did some research, and I found out the laws in my state and what was acceptable and unacceptable. They also had a maintenance worker come into my room without giving me notice, and I had him on the recording. He was looking around the room. I have him on the recording, just looking all around the room, reading stuff that, because I make little notes and things like that on my mirror. He's reading my information, and I think he was put up to that also. That was not something that was done by mistake. That was something that they had to have put him up to doing. So I had to basically fight to get my internet situation to together, and they were trying to tell me that they were trying not to fix the issue, but I had to end up buying some pieces in order to make my internet service work correctly. So I ended up getting them to reimburse me for the pieces that I bought. And I don't think that they liked the fact that I had some black self-respect and I stood up for myself, and I told them that it was by law that I am able to get them, I am able to deduct whatever I buy out of the rent. So they were insisting that I not do that, and that they just cut me a check. And what happened was I ended up getting into a discussion, or I guess a little disagreement with the superintendent. And she was basically trying to, she was being very manipulative, and she told me that I was making her upset because I was explaining to her, you know, I was telling her how the internet service wasn't working. So she told me that I made her upset and I was making her sad. And it was just all phony and just orchestrated and just, you know, manipulative tactics that she was using on me to make me feel like, feel bad. So what she ended up doing yesterday, she came to the house and she says to me, oh, we're sending out letters for renewal of the lease. And mind you, we just renewed the lease in August. And so she says to me, I didn't send out a renewal to you because of all the stuff that has been happening, and I'm quite sure you didn't want to sign the lease. So what I did, I stonewalled her, and I just said, I didn't show any emotion or anything, and I just said to her, okay. So it was like she was doing this like she was trying to get a reaction, and it was, you can tell it was being done on intentionally just to see what my reaction was going to be, and just so she can basically do something to disturb me, to make me feel, just to disrupt my day and make me feel bad, or as a shock, like, you know, to let me know that, you know, they're not renewing my lease. And it's all basically, it's like I'm being punished because I stood up to them, and they don't like that. So even the owner, because I told her, I had to, like, because she was trying to make me feel bad because I was speaking up and telling them that the service that I'm paying for, I'm not receiving, and that it's not right. And it was just like, you know, every week it was a constant ongoing situation. So once I stood up for myself and I finally put my foot down and I told them I was going to take it out my rent, now all of a sudden they're mad about it, you know, because I spoke up about it. So she, you can tell, like, she was trying to fish, bait me into reacting. So I just said to her, I said, okay. I said, okay to her. And what I said to her is that I asked her, why is it that you guys are sending out the notices so quick this month when they usually do it in December? But like I said, I think she just did that just to see if how I was going to react to it. And I didn't react in any kind of, I didn't get upset. I just stayed cool, calm, and collective. And I'm just going to have, you know, I am going to definitely be looking for a new spot to live. But it's just funny how they will scheme and plan to do things just to see if they can get a reaction out of us. And that's what I wanted to share on my housing situation. And thanks for listening.
Much obliged. Terrorizing non-white people at their residence is standard operating procedure. We've had a number of different programs about that. I'm glad you were able to stand up for yourself. You told us about the internet before and taking that out of the rent. Just checking the laws and seeing what you are entitled to as a renter. And whites definitely are not pleased to see Negroes reading, and much less reading to see what their rights are as anything that, oh, you know, I have the right to this, or I have access to that, or, you know, you're obligated to do this for me, you know, if you're going to be property manager or whatever it is. That's spectacular. And I'm not surprised at their form of retaliation. But just be mindful, and I'd be safe for the remainder of the time that you're there as well for any further retaliation or tackiness while you're, you know, still hanging out those few months or whatever. Other folks who we have missed totally, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, ma'am. Be heard.
That is Irie. Yes, ma'am.
It is. I figured, hi, Draftomania. I figure I'd go after my vocal twin. So I hope everybody is having a good evening. So this is for you directly, Gus. I sent you an email about Trevor Dooley because I was listening to your archives, and I looked him up because I couldn't believe what I was hearing, and he was actually granted an appeal. And the basis of the appeal is that it was improper jury instructions. You know, they were basically led to assume that he had already broken the law being on the playground with his weapon and that he brandished it unlawfully, and therefore he no longer had any legal right to stand his ground, which obviously is incorrect and also a falsehood. Because I just scanned through, you know, what they had in the appeal, and listening to the archive, you had, you know, obviously racist man, racist woman practicing racism through law. But he did get an appeal. And, of course, the widow or the girlfriend of the man, they're interviewing her, and she's almost tearful about how she can't believe he's going to be allowed to be free, you know, during his appeal. It's a travesty and yada, yada. I just also want to share my week. When I called in yesterday, I was actually in my, I guess you could say, first day of recovering from a serious illness that I still don't know for sure what I had. And I don't get sick often at all. Like, I don't get sick. And if I do, it's a very bad, like, whatever it is I have is potent because I take vitamins. I've been vegan for at least 8 months now, and I exercise every other day. And I'm not even talking about light exercise. I'm talking about Pilates, yoga, running, spinning, weightlifting. And so my head hurt toward the back of the head and the neck, and my shoulders and neck were tight, like really tight. I was feverish. I had chills. So because I don't have insurance, I went to the VA and they brought me in the ER, took some blood. So, a couple days later, I'm wondering why I didn't get any type of effective medicines like antibiotics or antivirals. I'm like, so what did I have? And they took 5 vials of blood from me. So when I called and I finally got in touch with somebody, the nurse was like, okay, well, your flu swab came back negative. I said, okay, that's great. I know I don't have the flu. What did I have? What happened to the blood work? She was like, what blood work? I said, no, you got to be kidding me. They took 5 vials from me, plus the urine specimen. What is going on? So long story short, they did whatever they wanted to do. They didn't record that they took the blood or the urine. I talked to the ER nurse to find out what their, good laboratory or clinical practices are with blood. And he admitted, white male, that the VA ER generally takes blood from people that come in, whether it's ordered or not. So I also asked him what happened to my blood specifically, and he refused to tell me. He told me that was something I would have to get for medical records. I ended up seeing my new primary care physician about, getting some type of diagnosis on record, and she put it down as a headache. And I asked her specifically, in your medical training, how has a headache been synonymous with fever past 100 degrees, night sweats, chills, muscle sores, and discombobulation, a headache, not a head injury? And she was like, well, generally it could. I said, well, I didn't ask you that. And I also want you to put in my record that patient disagrees with diagnosis. And she refused to do it. So I went to the patient advocate and I told her, and it was way more to it. But I told the patient advocate, who is a white female, and she may have been seriously puzzled by what happened, or she could have been putting on because she's a patient advocate. But she did ask me, what do you want to occur now that you're reporting this? I said, I would like to go to Dr. XYZ, and I would no longer want to be treated at the VA hospital because this is not the second time that someone has misdiagnosed me. But it's not the second time either that I've been summarily dismissed when I've asked a direct question, when I've made a demand in regard to my health record. And it's not the first time that people have shown me like I've been discarded, like we're done with you, get out of here. She said it would take time to get some kind of like report from, I guess, all the people that have to look into it or whatever. But I don't care what it takes at this point. I'm not going back to the VA. I knew the VA hospitals were pretty bad in this country. Like there's so many reports and it was awful. And I just got to do whatever I got to do to get some extra coverage so I can go to this black female doctor from now on. She's done everything in her power every time I've been there to help me. She asks questions. She's direct with me when she has specific concerns. And if she thinks that her concern is, she's just thorough. And I'm not going through that torture again. I'm thankful to be alive. I also, while I was recovering and feeling better, like able to sit up, I listened to a speech called The Three Evils by Dr. Martin Luther King, and it was actually his last speech in Memphis, not the I Have a Dream speech. And it was saddening because in it he admitted that he had been fooled by racist man and woman that they would change and stop practicing racism, and that instead they expanded by practicing racism in the Vietnam War and through some other means that, you know, he was shocked by. And he's noted how the young generation of people that, you know, got beat up, got, you know, the hoses put on them and the dogs put on him. They went to another speech he had and they booed him because they felt misled by him, when actually they all were misled by the people practicing racism. And he said that the dream had turned into a, quote, frustrated nightmare.
30 seconds.
And I really was sad to know that he was that, you know, confounded. And I think the goal of white people is to, some of them, is to get recorded and get on the internet terrorizing black people. It's like, it's their proof of dedication. And policing. We're doing our part to release, you know, police the you know, the nigger. So that's it. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, everyone. And thank you, guys.
Thank you, Irie. I am so glad to hear that you got your health back. That is so, so important. Cal's Yoga Retreat, taking care of ourselves, preserving our health so that we can stay out of the clutches of race soldiers wearing a doctor's coat or nurse's uniform or whatever it is. But I'm so glad to hear that you're feeling better and have recovered. That is horrendous on so many. I just kept saying Henrietta Lacks. Henrietta Lacks, Cal's Book Club, 2014. Henrietta Lacks. That's what I was thinking the whole time. And that's the language from the book, and from Henrietta Lacks' family specifically, raping the cells and stealing the very genetic material of black people. And then you can't even get a record. If you go to McDonald's and get a hamburger, they at least give you a receipt, don't you? Henrietta Lacks, medical apartheid too. That's also in the Cows book club, but Henrietta Lacks. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up and we have missed you totally, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. Thank you, Gus, once again for the platform. Let's start off with the NPR clip about talking to children early. As an attempted parent, I could really tell you it's very difficult. I live in New York City. They come after our offspring very early. And at the age of at least six, I saw that it was just very necessary to speak to him as soon as possible about it, and to convey it not in just a simple sit down and talk, but with passion, with force, and sometimes with anger. And that's just on my part as an attempted parent. Sometimes you will be angry about the situation, not because they don't understand, but just because you know that if they don't understand, the greater chances of them being mistreated and not being able to come to you and speak to you about it. At my son's school, it was predominantly white females. It's predominantly white females who were trying to put him in a special class so that he would be separate from the rest of the quote-unquote children in school. And it was a very difficult scenario to actually fight that back. I literally lost two jobs in the process of trying to make sure that he didn't get put in any special programs. And they called the ambulance on him. They took him to the hospital so he can get diagnosed as mentally unstable. And this is happening to a child that's in second grade, by the way. And this goes to the next clip of regards to why, you know, the white woman yelling at the child, terrorizing him. And it's a difficult thing to deal with as a parent because they can't defend themselves. But if you speak to them and tell them about it, they can then come to you and then you could act on their behalf to some degree. I do agree the terminologies that are used, the barbecue Becky and all these other things minimizes the actual danger and issues that they're actually causing, that terrorism. It minimizes it to the point it makes it comical. And I don't think we should make it comical at all, because people are actually going to jail or getting into or suffering some serious type of stress from that situation. Living in New York City, I'll speak on some of what you just said about Harlem. That's not just Harlem. I mean, they're using that as, you know, one of the conversations, but gentrification is a very, very, very important topic in most so-called Black communities. I live in Bed-Stuy, and I could tell you that it's a very, very big topic. I could walk down the street in these areas, and almost every street, there's always one person talking about, do you see them moving in? Do you see how they're going up the block now? Do you see this new building they're building? And I mean, I literally did it today as I went out for a bike ride, and I could hear people having the conversation because it's nice weather and the quote unquote white people are out. And you get to see how many there are moving into the neighborhood and taking over pretty much to some degree, coming and taking back what they want. The Dixie clip, now, I think was very important. There was a comment and made there that I wanted to ask the rest of the callers as well as yourself. One of the people they interviewed said, it's important to have these things changed, the name Dixie and any kind of memorials in regards to that. And she stated that these symbols contain and hold a certain type of energy with them, and that's why it's important to get them removed and taken away. And based off my what I've seen, most people do hold items, material items, and words, names, everything, and give them a certain type of energy to them, whether it be negative or positive. But I believe that she definitely had a point in stating that. How effective it will be removing them and the results, I can't tell. But I was curious if anybody else felt the same way about removing these so-called these symbols, and do they hold a certain type of energy to them? And one last thing, just trying to, at least as far as my code I've been working on, is just maintaining my time, trying to be as effective as possible with the time that I have, whether it be at work, whether it be at home, just being cautious of the time that I have, because I've noticed that people take my time and energy for granted, especially on my plantation, where whites tend to feel like they can talk to me and speak to me about their issues and their life and how difficult things are. And it's a very stressful scenario where I tend to kind of now pull out by saying, oh, got an email, I got to get going. It's a pleasure talking with you, got to go. But I noticed that pattern, and I noticed it also with non-white people, but, you know, VGQ. But that's something that I've been working on, is just minimizing the time wasted in my day-to-day life, because we just don't have that much time and energy to put out, and we don't need to waste it doing anything that's not constructive. That'll be it for me, and thank you all. Mute my line.
Much obliged, dear sir. Bravo on that is Black self-respect right there. I value my time and energy. That is such a critical component of this system, wasting Black and non-white people's time and energy, and or just having us invest all of our time and energy in support of strengthening the system of racism. So that is huge. That's super important. Mr. Fuller talks about that, four things that we should be doing: exchanging views, eating and sleeping correctly, constructive uses of time and energy. He talks about it explicitly in his code book. I also wanted to end, nobody has an infinite amount of time and energy. So definitely that is a resource that you want to be mindful of. And that we talk about that on workplace racism all the time. White people wasting your time talking to you about nonsense, their personal problems, their sex life. Like, come on, they had the report I played yesterday. White man said, or excuse me, someone who I suspect is white identifies as transgender, said this person said that they spent 8 months writing a letter to their coworkers and boss about their transition and being transgender. The number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The Cows is updated on iTunes as well. Forgot I was going to say that also. I know we had been We've been facing mass interruptions for year, really the entire time that we've been broadcasting, the entire decade, but the iTunes feed should be up and working for downloads, streams. I checked it a few times. At least it worked for me. So that should be working if that is your preferred method for accessing the Kai's archives. iTunes should be back and working. The person who just spoke up, did you have a quick comment you were going to add?
No, it was just a question I asked yourself as well as the other listeners or callers. Do you kind of agree with the statement that the lady made in the comment and about Dixieland, and stating that she believes that certain things hold a certain amount of energy in them, and that removing them will help the situation? I was just curious if anybody else as well as yourself felt the same. I kind of see it from time to time when people remove certain things, but I was wondering if anybody else.
My view, I've been pretty consistent with that. There are so many symbols and monuments and statues of white supremacy. We've done programs about that. I mean, you know, are they going to change Jacksonville? The retired firefighter said that last week. Are they going to change Washington State where I am? Are they going to change that? How many things would have to be changed as long as, and even after you do all of that, we're still in a system of racism. But I mean, man, we could take another centuries just going around and trying to rename all of the things and take down all of the monuments. And where are we going to store all of the statues to racists? It's so many you couldn't even add them all up. It's so many, and the names and everything else is so many you couldn't even add them all. So I am my view, if we end the system of white supremacy racism, then it'll be much easier to go around and do that and to collect and change all of them. But as long as the system is still here, it probably won't even be worth the time and energy to change all of that. It probably won't even be possible with the system still here. Whites that's why they have so many of those monuments. I've said it before. It is the same environment. If you want to think about athletics, you have a home team. There is an energy to them having all of the paraphernalia up that reflects them. They understand it. It's the same principle. The entire known universe is home field advantage for the system of white supremacy now. So all of the cheerleaders and the monuments and paraphernalia is going to support racism, white supremacy until this system has been replaced with justice. That's been my stance for a long time. Keep the monuments, Confederate flag, all of that up as a reminder of what we are supposed to be focused on. As I think the caller just said, the confusion. So many of us get confused about what it is. Maybe those reminders will help us stay focused. That's been my view for years. Other folks, did you have comments? Folks we missed totally, did you all have comments? Seems like folks are, we have a number of hands up. I guess folks are getting to a spot where they can speak or gathering their thoughts. Please do not wait till the last minute for the folks who dialed in and do have a hand up for things that they wanted to share. I will get in my other comment quickly while folks are waiting. The white woman in the case who was stalking the young black 14-year-old male, that'd be another great illustration of black male privilege. the white woman in that instance, I said his name earlier, Trayvon Martin's killer, she sounded exactly like him. Like the that's exactly what he said on the 911 call. They always get away with it. The exact same type of verbiage. That, I mean, that sort of rhetoric, that sort of thought process, that this is not just a one-time thing, that you niggers are constantly doing these type of things to violate me, to violate us, and you're going to get it. Might be today. If I had a rifle on me, you'd be dead in the street right now, gun rapping, dropping niggers down in Florida. Other folks who dialed in have comments that we missed totally.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, Imhan DC.
Yes, sir. Greetings to everyone. I wanted to speak about a few things, and one of them, one of the callers spoke about time and energy, and you're speaking about time and energy. And I know Dr. Wilson and Mr. Fuller and a number of other black speakers speak about time and energy. And I heard Dr. Wilson saying that her mission in life was to end white supremacy. And that's also my mission in life, is to end white supremacy. And then some, the time and energy that I have while I'm alive, I would have to spend it trying to end white supremacy in order to fulfill that mission. The other thing I wanted to say was about chemtrails. I think the units of measurement, or I think what they would call it is like gigatons, the amount of, like that's how you would measure the amount of particles that they're spraying into the sky, if I have that correct. It wouldn't be this cold right now, like it is right now. It would be warm. Well, I don't know what the temperature is in your part of the world, but where I am, the temperature is cold. But it's because they've been able to block out the sun since the seasons are changing. But the nights would be warmer if they hadn't done certain things to make it cold over here. So climate change, the temperature is getting hot, so global warming, or the planet is getting hotter. And white people are saying that because the planet is getting hotter, we're going to have like more rainfall and more cold days and more snowfall. But no, that's nonsense. I mean, maybe you can have more rainfall. I can understand that. But white people are spraying particles into the sky that are causing these clouds to form. And that's where a good portion of the rain is coming from. But the last thing I wanted to say was, I remember what I was going to say a number of weeks ago. It was, we should, as indigenous people, black people in America, we should do a campaign to deport white people and deport Arabs. Won't be successful with that campaign for a period of time. Eventually, that's ultimately what's going to happen. And deport Chinese, and deport whoever is not in our best interest. That could be incorrect, but I think that could have some positive effect. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, lines should be open. Proceed. Folks that we missed totally. Folks that we missed totally. Did we nab all the folks who had hands up? Looked like there were folks we were still missing. Let's see.
Tom, you heard?
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, Gus. How are you? How's all the callers? Right, Paulie. Right, Paulie is always still learning. I know. Absolutely. And Lennox Terrace, which is in a good area. I mean, it's by Harlem Hospital, the Schomburg Center. But, I mean, to me, it always just looked like a fancy project, you know, got terrorists. But it still looked like a project, you know, for me. At I don't want to say this lady's name wrong, but I just got breaking news on this one. Her name is Atayana Jefferson, killed in her home by police in Fort Worth, Texas. The police officer shot her through her bedroom window. He was in her backyard. He was responding to a non-emergency call. I believe a neighbor had a wellness check call. There's body cam footage of the shooting. And the lady was playing a video game with her nephew at the time she was shot. And this is all allegedly. This is just, you know, what the, I'll send you the article. And she had a degree in biology and chemistry from Xavier University. But that just happened. They're saying this is a Amber Geiger case, that she was in her house and killed by a cop, even though he shot from the outside in a scene fight. So that just happened in the last 4 hours, I believe. That's the first article I saw on it 4 hours ago. All people legally are criminals, and they're being used by the white supremacists to further confuse us. And in my opinion, they all need to be sent back to their place of origin. Africans in Mexico trying to enter the United States. You know, just the irony of that. You know, I saw several articles on this type of thing over the past 2 years. Video footage of them crossing the Rio Grande, being arrested by Border Patrol. Just not rational. Thousands of Africans somehow end up in Mexico, attempting to enter the United States. You know, logically, I would have to ask some questions. How did Africans get to Mexico? Who funded this? Why would Africans be seeking refuge and leave their continent where they have over 50 countries that they could be have seek refuge in other than the one they're in? And how did they end up thousands of miles across the ocean to seek refuge, and they're in a country where they're safe? Why would they want to go to another country? Why not go to stay in Mexico or go to Guatemala, Panama, or somewhere else? So a lot of questions to be asked. You know, if you ask Google these questions, you'll start to get the answer. That's all I'll say on that. I don't want to sound the top black. I disagree on the Trump clip. I think Trump has been 100% equal in who he has attacked, be it race or gender. Anyone who has attacked him, he's attacked them back then 24 hours or so, either by Twitter or in some other fashion. The white supremacists are using the Black Caucus and the so-called squad to consistently attack Trump. And he has consistently counterattacked them. Now, somehow, wanting to keep, you know, most of this is about the Black Caucus being used by white supremacists to take up the issue of keeping people in the country illegally. And the black politicians have, you know,
are using the struggle we've had with white supremacy sort of as a justification of this. But of course, like I said, they're being used by the white supremacists. The Trump speech, black media decided to talk about the squad and his comments in that regard. However, the real story, you know, you had to grab your popcorn and a beverage, sit back and relax. After the Trump speech, you had white people fighting white people. The very dangerous, deadly white supremacist terrorist group called the Antifa. And Antifa-like organizations strategically placed themselves around the venue and began attacking Trump supporters as they left. Most of it verbal, but some of it was physical. It was all on camera, knocking off people's MAGA hats, locking them in the parking spaces, causing people to have to either ram them with their cars or get out the cars and push them out the way, and just causing. So the beauty in this was just the first big event. So we got a whole year of white people fighting white people coming on. The president, of course, white supremacist, uses white supremacy brilliantly in his rhetoric. During the speech, he had the white cops and Minnesota first responders come up on stage and talk about their Trump T-shirts. And as soon as, you know, got the crowd all going and clapping and they calmed down, and he came right back. He said, you know, we got to get rid of these Somalians y'all guys. And those people jumped up out their seats like, man, I said, man, this dude's a genius. I mute my line, Gus. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Other folks that we have missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Hi, Gus.
Greetings, B in Toronto.
Greetings to you, callers and listeners. I just wanted to give you a heads up that, give you the information that there has been some difficulties with accessing the line. I know that when I first called, then the call dropped and then re-entered back again. So just wanted to keep you informed. So the next part, wanted to also say, I wanted to commend, yourself, callers and listeners, in your efforts to fight against white supremacy. It is very brave, courageous and justified, task as it's definitely a system that causes mistreatment, terror, and injustice on non-whites. So again, I thank everyone who tunes into the cows and are also actively pursuing in the destruction of white supremacy, because it is an evil system that needs to be completely erased. For Adraptomania, I remember you had mentioned that there was a technician that had come into your unit without notice. I would urge you to contact your landlord about that, also review the landlord-tenant agreement on that, because landlords are designated by law to at least give 24 hours notice to tenants before allowing technicians to access. Because you have footage that is excellent, keep that as evidence, and definitely find out ways of what you can do with this current evidence that you have and any other mistreatments that the landlord and or tenants pursue against you. For Irie, Henrietta Lacks came to mind as well, regarding the VA health situation, with what they did with they basically stole your biological information without your consent and without disclosure as to why. And I believe that there should be something about that in terms of consent and disclosure, especially in light of what happened with the Tuskegee syphilis situation, and also all the infractions that were outlined through medical apartheid. I would urge you to seek further information as to how you can get this reported and how to have this investigated, because again, this is your biological information that they've technically stolen. Also, in terms of what happened to the young 14-year-old who was being terrorized by the white woman, this is white women at work. This is what they do. The tactics are so familiar. They do the same thing in across all environments, where they would aggress, terrorize, and they would also triangulate, meaning that they would get others to join in on the abuse and mistreatment. And despite the fact that there is a video of this person doing this to terrorizing the child, you know, it's really interesting how there is no charges of child abuse against her, how she wasn't charged with a hate crime for doing what she was doing, or even child endangerment with what she was doing as well, with getting more people to join in on the abuse. So the journalist was rather negligent in their duty to report, to the appropriate authorities. I hope that something is pursued and that this is not just another meme, so to speak, with a catchy falsified phrase attributed to this white terrorist. I hope that something is done about it. Thank you, Thomas, for the breaking news on what's happened. Again, you know, this is evidence of white terrorism at work. I truly believe that we should really abide by the universal law of self-preservation. Do whatever we can to self-preserve, be it Black self-respect, taking care of our bodies, making sure that we're getting exercise, making sure that we're able to defend ourselves if we need to, making sure that we're able to protect ourselves and know the escape routes if we need to, knowing who to connect with. So building up a network and finding out where those safe spots would be as much as possible. And thank you, and I leave the line.
Much obliged, B in Toronto. Thank you so much for letting me know about the difficulty in dialing in, because I thought I saw you originally, and then it looked like you had to hang up and dial back in. So thank you for letting me know about it. Didn't I just say it's been a whole decade of interference all the way through? Phone lines. Yet, speaking of interference, even yesterday, I was workplace racism. We had the audio clip. Things were fine. And then I started speaking. I'm not sure if there was a wire that got disconnected or what have you, but it caused distortion in my audio for like the first 40 minutes or so yesterday. Interference all the way. Retired firefighter and Stacy and some of the other folks messaged me and let me know having problems so we could get it corrected yesterday. But it's been a whole decade of interference and white terrorism. Speaking of white terrorism, B in Toronto reminded me, Henrietta Lacks, I mentioned yesterday during the distortion that my 3-month internship at the 1-month mark, the white woman studio owner asked, hey, you should get paid for this. You're good enough. You don't need to do this for free the entire time. Let's have you go ahead and apply for a job. They have the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks on the bookshelf in their library at the yoga studio. And I said, oh my, that is one question. Boop. I will ask now. I'll update you all and see what happens if I actually do become employed to teach yoga here. But that is question number one. Why exactly do you have that book in a yoga library? I don't see any, like, they don't have Ta-Nehisi Coates or, you know, Tim Wise or Robin DiAngelo, but Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, they got it on the bookshelf. Are there any questions, any of the folks that are with us? Book Club 2014, Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, Rebecca Skloot. Any questions you would ask a white person who has read that book? Well, I guess that'd be one, has she read it? But any questions you would ask a white person who has that book, has read that book, or promotes it, like, oh, wow, this is a book you should read. You want to know about racism in the medical industry. Wow. Get Henrietta Lacks. Or any questions you would ask a white person who says, oh, yeah, I like this book. That's one you all can think on and share if something comes to mind in the archives. Other folks we've not heard from at all. Let me get the number one more time. 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks, we missed totally. If you have commentary, I think the question about the energy in white supremacy symbols and should they be removed, caller wanted comments to that question as well. Other folks we missed totally?
Glad to hear.
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. The woman who came up with the term the New American Classic for the Hate U Give, her statements regarding Amber Geiger and Brent Jean and the judge were misinterpreted or misrepresented. She never said that she was upset by either of their behavior. She said that she became disinterested in the case once these things took place because she knew that the focus would be removed from the race soldier and be put on the victims. She also said that she thought that it was noble that the judge wanted to give the race soldier a Bible and things of that nature. She just didn't think that it should be done in front of the jury and that it should be done after sentencing so that it wouldn't influence sentencing. It was also stated that we don't forgive our family members. We forgive our family members every day. People just choose to focus on the times when we don't. I mean, even Martin Luther King Sr., Dr. King's father, forgave the person who murdered his mother, who was a black man, supposedly. And also the jury and the judge in the Amber Geiger case, they were given that case to take the blame. We should be upset with Amber Geiger, not anyone else. I mean, she's the one who murdered Bossom, and we should be upset with her for hugging or even asking for a hug or any of that or hugging any of her victims or any of that. It's like a rapist hugging the person that they raped. And you want to talk about forgiveness, we should forgive him for and the judge and all these people that we're speaking negatively about. And they had every reason to believe the Brent Jean, which is Botham's brother, as well as the judge, every reason to believe that they would be next to be murdered. Just like the person who testified who got murdered, I believe Erica Garner was murdered. Even though they said she died of a heart attack, they said the same thing about Natalie Cole's son, who was going to inherit his mother's estate. But Erica Garner, she refused to forgive and said she did not forgive. And then now she's dead at 27, talking about she died from a heart attack. And there's plenty of people, like in the Charleston massacre from Dylan Storm Roof, there's plenty of those people who refuse to forgive, but white people just, they bring out the people who say that they forgive, but they don't really give a lot of coverage to the people who don't say that. And we don't know also if these people forgive or not, that most likely they are just saying that because they're afraid. And so there's just this general, and there's no evidence that black people in general are always forgiving races. There's evidence that it's being done publicly, but that is most likely coerced. Just a couple of things, two more things I wanted to say, two or three. We talk about, you know, helping white people and criticize other black people for helping white people. We're talking about victims in this way and criticizing them in this way, victims of terrorism like Brant Jean and the judge and all these people. That helps racists. And the last two things I wanted to say is that DeKalb's radio program, Gus, is black self-respect. You just making this program is black self-respect. And I just wanted to answer your question real quick. One thing that came to mind about a white person who said, I think you said it, a white person who said that they have and they like Rebecca Skloot's book, I would ask them, what do they like about it? Like, in detail, what specifically do they like about that book? Is that what you said, a white person who has the book and likes it and has read it?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, that was it. Thank you. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus, and everybody have a good weekend. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Ivy. Black self-respect. Dr. Wellesen talked about it all the time. Crucial. Other folks that we missed totally, if you have comments, questions, suggestions to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to start out with, there was a news report that I saw. Apparently it was a white woman caught on video, or she was, I guess, being on a cell phone video calling a victim. Sounded like she was calling him a nigger or some kind of a racial slur. And apparently the victim was also being there were also terms like he was on welfare, or that you're probably on welfare. I guess he was a part of some school or something, that she was a teacher or maybe PE teacher or something. And the victim says, well, I have six-figure salary or whatever. But even though he has that, she still seen him as a nigger. And I just found that interesting that it was caused just by some kind of a dent or something on a truck. Maybe they had some kind of a car collision, a vehicle collision, slight vehicle collision, and racism was being practiced. So I don't know if the person was fired or not. Maybe she was. It was just a segment that I saw. I think it was yesterday. My next one is on the segment where it was talking about the Trump tweets, and the terms were being used, where the guy says that he takes pleasure, that term was used, takes pleasure in using vitriolic language against women and minorities, Muslims. And that can definitely be confusing when it comes to women and minorities. And the term AOC plus three was used, and it reminded me of John and Kate plus eight. I think that was a TV show. So plus eight, from my understanding, is applying to the children. So maybe the plus three, I guess, could be using that same analogy. And the one on the lady from down here in St. Pete, here in Florida, I do catch on to that as well, where they will use these cartoony names, Pick That Up Peggy, Gum Rapper Gretchen. And I noticed that as well, they do tend to use alliteration. And that's also in there with metaphor and simile. They use that as a way to confuse victims of racism, to trivialize racism, and thus for us not to describe these acts as an act of white supremacy racism. And I just really wanted to end it off by saying I am drinking at least a gallon of water a day. I got a new water bottle off of Amazon, and I've been able to put it to good use and drinking more water. And that's all I have to share right now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
I'm envious. A gallon a day. Wow. That is spectacular. Drink that water. That is Black self-respect right there, really being disciplined, committed, dedicated to doing things that are going to nourish your body long-term for life. Drink that water. Let's see. Other, for an alliterate, absolutely. Paying attention to words, the alliteration. I said it's making it sound kind of nursery rhymey. Other folks who we have missed totally. If you have comments, questions, gripes, you wanted to respond to any of the questions that have been submitted, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, good evening. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to thank Miss Ivy. I guess something I said was misconstrued, and she corrected it. Thank you. As you can see, I don't know what was said. I guess it was after I talk. Usually after I talk, I go do something else, not just kind of listen. That's, I don't know, things don't. The older you get, I guess things like that don't bother you. And I know we're all learning and growing, so no hard feelings to anyone. I don't know, like I said, I don't even know what was said, so I can't even say any hard feelings because I don't know what was said, whatever. But on another note, I know everyone's into exercising, and I'm trying to exercise as well. And I wanted to know if anybody, like, had any or saw any videos or clips on my breathing, because I know I tend to have a problem breathing when I exercise, and I know I run out of breath very quickly. I think quicker than I should from doing the exercise that I do and something like that to kind of control my breathing so that when I exercise, I don't get winded so quickly, because I got especially winded today. I didn't feel good about that. I wanted to. I mean, I did the best I could throughout the program, the exercise class, but. And I guess that is all. The clips were good. Yeah. Thank you. And usually I don't call this late, but since someone said something about me, I figured I should respond, and I heard it. Thank you.
When just real quick, when you say clips about breathing, you said like, or videos about breathing, you said that was like a breathing exercise or something that would help you breathe more efficiently, just so I can understand.
Yes, when I'm exercising. Yes.
Okay. I can't say I can think of any like videos per se. I had to think about that, like a video to help you breathe more efficiently. This is not just like shameless self-interest, but that is supposedly one of the benefits of yoga. I mean, a lot of it breathing. We did a lot of breathing exercises at the retreat in Virginia is breathing. Like, I don't know if you practice yoga already, but that is supposed to be like you do a lot of breathing exercises and it encourages deep breathing. So that can be helpful.
Okay, that's fine.
But if other folks, I'll have to double check because there might be better resources or other resources specifically. But yoga, I mean, there are a lot of breathing exercises done in yoga, or can be a lot of breathing exercises done.
Oh, and the exercise I'm doing is that bar stuff. It's kind of addictive. I don't, because it's expensive, but it's kind of addictive. And you don't, they say it's part yoga Pilates. I don't know. I don't do all that. I do this bar thing.
Right on.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Yes. Hello? Ma'am. Breathing is important. Irie?
Yeah. I sing without letting the sound come out while I'm exercising, but you sound like you're in a class setting, so that might not work. But if you're doing something alone, you could do it that way, because there's measure, obviously, in the music, and it'll give you a certain time to inhale and exhale, you know, to at least the beat.
Okay, thank you. I tried that. They have music, and I already stand out because I don't look like the majority of the participants. So anything, I mean, I'm already standing out. So if I have to sing, I paid for it, just like they did. Blah, blah, blah. Thank you.
Dig it. Let's see. Other folks that we missed totally, if we have any folks who have suggestions for breathing exercises or any more responses to the question about the white supremacy symbols, or if you just have your own questions, you want to submit suggestions, comments. If we've missed you totally, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings to you, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. The clip that you played earlier in regards to cricket, I remember a book C.L.R. James did on cricket, and I believe it's about politics and racism within the cricket game. C.L.R. James is also the author of The Black Jacobins, a book about the Haitian Revolution. So that'll be an interesting book to, you know, maybe consider in the book club. I'd like to know more about that book about what your grandparents eat. You are what your grandparents eat. Because I have two grandparents who, one grandparent who lived until he was 95, and then another grandparent lived until, he died early. He died like in the 60s. But they were both bad eaters. So I was just wondering, like, I'd like to know more about that book and where the, you know, the history of, you know, in my family history, where does that, you know, where does that stand? The man who got 10 days in jail for being late to jury duty, obviously victims of racism don't get the benefit of the doubt in the racist judicial system. You get 10 days in jail for being late for jury duty. Amber Geiger gets 10 years for murder. Jason Van Dyke gets 7 years for murder. The lowest sentencing of murderers that I've ever seen. Typically, you know, from what I've seen, murderers get, you know, at the minimum 20 years. So that's interesting. Oh, and she gets eligible for parole in 5. The New York, the Harlem being the oasis of black people. When you mentioned that, when you're talking about the area of New York, kind of remind me of, it was like a Tar Baby reference where we were talking about the two characters arguing about, you know, New York being this great place. I think it was J. Dean who argued about that, and Son arguing about his place, Elo, being a great place, and, you know, how we as victims argue, you know, what's the best plantation to live in. So I think that's pretty amusing that, you know, we would argue such trivial stuff about what's the best plantation to live in. And, you know, black folks don't, you know, we don't own any of that particular area or space. And lastly, there was a report that was released by the Attorney General here in Chicago in regards to the Laquan McDonald shooting, the 500-page report. And it basically talked about the internal cover-up that happened during that case. And what is so amazing is the chief of police here, Johnson, is the one who is the center of the center of controversy, because I guess apparently in the report, he said, now this is a non-white black guy, victim of racism, who is currently the chief of police here in Chicago. But it seems like all the attention is on him because of the fact that I guess during this time, he wasn't the chief during that time, he was a commander of the district. And all the attention's on him because they said he reviewed the tape and said that there was, you know, there was no wrongdoing. However, none of the attention is going to the report had listed 11 police officers who were complicit, all of them white, complicit in this cover-up. Only 4 got fired, and also implicating the mayor of Chicago, or the former mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel. So it's amazing how skillful white people can still put this on a black man, but yet they implicate 11 police officers in this cover-up and the mayor of Chicago, or the former mayor of Chicago. So I find that pretty interesting. that, you know, the black man still gets blamed for this. So that's all I have on my life.
The black male is feverish and always to be blamed. Black people in general. CLR James, I got fussed at and called names talking about Mr. CLR James and particularly mentioning who he was married to. I got in trouble and fussed at. Man. Anyway, not that he doesn't have constructive information about white supremacy, racism, but I mean, cowbell. Other folks who dialed in that we've missed totally, do you have commentary to share?
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter, yes, sir. And I'm sorry, retired firefighter. I did just post, I tweeted about the book You Are What Your Grandparents Ate by Judith Finlayson. Her last name is Finlayson, Finlayson. You Are What Your Grandparents Ate. Thank you, retired firefighter, for your patience.
Yes, sir. I would ask a question sort of like to a white person who has read the book. How do you illustrate justice when a non-white black person's body parts are being distributed and sold for profit? That would be kind of like the fashion of questions that I would ask that particular white person who approaches me with the interest into the end of that book. The clip that you constantly play of Mr. Fuller stating that something along the lines of the LGBT community is changing a lot of things, it says something sort of like that, is very relevant based on what I have been given some attention to. You know, just flicking the different clips on YouTube, and I came across one or two of them, to whereas in the people activity of sex, which is being contaminated by the global system of racist white supremacy, they have quote unquote children's books. See, they're not going to go to a certain age of non-white people with this matter, with this sexual confusion matter. They're going to 5 and 6 year olds. I've seen a book that is just like books that are identified as children books. One of them is a book on alphabets, whereas they would say, okay, the letter A, and then they would give a word that begins with the letter A. Well, I can't think of a letter that would be synonymous with anti-sexual behavior with letter A, but B would be, it would say something like B is for bisexual. And then it would go on with a definition of the word. T is for transvestite. And they would go on with a definition to that word, that sort of thing like that, with a nice, I think it has some kind of recording with the book also, to whereas it would give some kind of childlike tune to it. And there was another clip. There was another clip on the collegiate level, to whereas at some of these quote unquote HCBUs, and I went to two quote unquote historical black colleges myself and graduated from them, but they are having trouble, according to the articles, that black males are demanding to enter into the sororities, the black female sororities, They actually are demanding meaning that they are applying for civil action, quote unquote, to be able to get into Alpha Kappa Alpha and Delta Sigma Theta sorority. And all through the clips, the people who, the females who are a part of the organization, are kind of like being bewildered on how to deal with the matter. Now, mind you, now this is something that I think is totally orchestrated by the white supremacists for that very purpose. For non-white people to be confused and to be fussing and fighting with each other on such a matter. Just an observation that I had during the week. Today was the second session of this particular group of younger black males. The featured part of the session, we watched part two of the Central Park Five documentary. I forgot what was the exact title of it, but I think mostly everybody knew what I'm talking about, the documentary. And I'm not going to talk about the documentary itself because most people that are listening to me right now have already seen it and know what part two was compiled of. And once again, it captivated their attention. Again, and we also made commentary during the parts of it with some of the younger kids to actually make it understanding to what was actually going on and the different practices and methods and strategies of how racist white supremacists operate. And that's my report for this week. Thank you.
Just wanted to double check. Is this the segment? Is this the project that Ava DuVernay constructed, which you all are watching, or is it a different one? Just making sure I'm not confused. Retired firefighter.
Oh, you mean of the Central Park Five?
Yes.
I'm trying to think. I can't remember the name of that title of the It's not, it wasn't a documentary. It actually was a where they had actors playing the part.
Okay.
Of the Central Park Five.
The Ava DuVernay project. That's why I wanted to ask, because that is not, you know, a documentary. The words are
right. I've been saying the wrong word. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not a documentary. You're exactly right.
Yeah. That one is important because that one, yeah, as you said, that's actors and all that. And I don't even know if that is very popular. Lots and lots of people have been seeing it, talking about it. You can put the cowbell in for that one. Yeah. Yeah. Just important to get that in. Not a documentary. Yes, sir. Give me 1 second, Thomas in New York. Did we nab anybody? Anybody that we missed totally? Good. We'll assume we're great. Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Great. I believe they call those docu-series, kind of sounds like documentaries. I think that's the act of confusion. The gentleman spoke about the teacher who was taped calling the black parent. He had a fender bender with her, looked like he tapped into a back fender. And it was reported that she was suspended. But she said that you're probably on welfare. He said, why? Because I'm black. She said, yes. Like, I make six figures, like, that matters. She said, yeah, right. You know, you're probably homeless. He says, I have a 4,000 square foot house, like, that matters. But I liked how he did it because he kept the conversation going, because you could tell that he started taping after the initial altercation and most of her verbal assault stopped. So he started taping, and by him repeating stuff that she had already said, it got her to have to contract to say whether she said it or not, but she just kept it going. I thought that was a very smart tactic. She started running toward him a couple of times. He told her that wouldn't be a good idea for you. You know, it could turn real dangerous for you. And she retreated and just went back to her verbal assault. The question, whites taking down the racist statue, while the system of white supremacy still exists, would just be a huge act of racism on behalf of the white supremacists. That's deception and confusion. And Gus, you should ask if she thinks Rebecca Scoop was practicing racism. I mean, Milan, thank
you. Not
yet. Ivy, yes, ma'am.
Just real quick, to the woman who thanked me about her statements from, I believe it was last week, you're welcome. That was it. I'm in my line.
Much obliged. We did our 3 hours. Hope folks got everything they wanted to share. We should be back. As I said, Dr. Lathan should be with us soon. I'm looking forward to hearing some of her thoughts on the updates that they recently provided, saying that red meat is not that bad, can have that and be healthy and great, and just in eating healthy. In fact, I had a black mother. She spoke to me and she was saying it would be great to have input on things that she can do to help because she has a child. And so it's a little bit more challenging for her to just change her diet because she has young children. And so they might not necessarily want hummus, you know, or kale or beets or whatever. You know, like, what do you do if you're trying to eat more healthy and you have very young children who are a little bit picky about what they want to eat? So stay tuned. We'll have the exact time, date, all of that information for Dr. Lathan's return. Other guests, just check Black Talk Radio Network, Facebook. Thanks again to Be in Toronto letting us know about the interference. Other folks have noted that as well. I myself had some problems recently as well, to be expected. The retreat again, lowered the price by $200, dropped it down to $730. Deposit of $380 would be due October 24th. And then the final deposit is due in December. It's all listed on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Price dropped by $200. Everyone, even the folks who already paid, same price, $730. Down in Florida, December 28th to January 1. Let me know if you have other questions, need additional details. With that, thanks for everyone's participation. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy this Saturday evening. Great questions. I broke those down to ask for Henrietta Lacks. We'll let you know when I get answers. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. And while we are driving, being buckled up, driver or passenger, every time, just to minimize the likelihood of us being another victim of white supremacy, like Chicago's Laquan McDonald, the victim that was mentioned tonight in the Texas area, Miss Jefferson, buckled up every time, just trying to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. And if we're going to be driving, we are not on the cell phone, just trying to stay as safe as we can under extremely dangerous conditions. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person, even when we're by ourselves. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. The Grandcestor, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.